I'd like to call the meeting of the Charter School Subcommittee of our Education Committee in the Senate to order. It is Friday, March 6th. Today we'll be hearing five bills, and I want to thank everyone who's here. We have spent about 3 months working in our Charter School Working Group on this issue, and I want to thank the many people who have testified before us. We have probably spent more time on this issue than we have spent on charter schools in the past 15 years. So I really, really appreciate that we've heard from many of the stakeholder groups, from parents, individuals, teachers. And so today what we'll be doing is hearing five bills that are the legislation dealing with charter school reform. And I think what's important to note is that three of these bills really take the same section of statute and present some different legislation. Some of it is very similar. So we're going to be hearing those two, those three bills today. Senator Hahn has a bill. He is not with us today, but we will hear the testimony on it. And then I have a bill as well on school employment protection. We'll be hearing that. My intent today, members, is to lay all these bills on the table at the end. And then next Wednesday at 3 o'clock, we will have another meeting of this group. And I will be bringing out, and I'll be talking with some of you about, I'm using Senate File 867 as the vehicle bill for a charter school package, and that is a companion bill to the House bill that is going through on the House side. So it will provide an opportunity for us to each have that. So today, as we listen to these bills, please take notes of those things in different bills that you find you really like, those things that are, you know, concerning to you. I will tell you that I think that we have had a small working group, and you've just been, you know, really tremendous about being here, being very engaged. But our full committee has not learned as much as we have. So I think that when our bill comes out of this committee, I'd like to have a little menu of options for the full committee to member or to like hear from us on. So the final bill may not be a perfect bill coming out of this committee, but I'd like the rest of our members to sort of hear some of the proposals that came from this group so that they can, again, hear the testimony and have some options. But again, I do want to thank you. You know, the other thing I just want to note is that on charter school reform is that I see this committee is that we are really working to make our charter schools stronger in this state, that the intent of this group is not to damage all of the growth that has taken place, but to ensure that in moving forward, as we look for options for students, for also accountability, looking also for ways for schools to try new things, that the public is very comfortable with the system that we have established for that. So that's, I think, where I see our purpose here. I'd like to start today, and are there questions at all from the groups or else comments from the members before we get started? Anything? All right. I think we'll get started with Senate File 718, and since Senator Hahn is not here, we have Mr. Piccolo, who is with the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools, and this bill is similar to a bill that I also introduced, in that it allows charter schools to have first option of leasing or purchasing an empty school building. And also allows charter schools to use state money to purchase buildings, which right now is something that we've discussed. There's sort of an alternative method for that happening. So, Mr. Piccolo, thank you for being here today.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity, and I want to echo your comments. We thank the committee, the working group that's been involved in this for the last several months, looking at all the charter school issues. We believe that there is a need to raise the whole level of what we've been doing in charter schools, and so we thank you for the opportunity to have to testify through these hearings on the proposals that we've put forth on charter schools. In terms of 718, as you mentioned, Madam Chair, this basically would give charter schools a first option to request to lease or purchase through their building companies vacant public school buildings that are already paid for through taxpayers. So this would actually reduce costs to the state in terms of the fact that these buildings have already been paid for. So we strongly support this measure or the measure that you've introduced that is similar in nature.
Very good. Are there questions from the group? Senator Bonoff.
Madam Chair, Mr. Piccolo, the concern that I have around this provision is regarding the what happens when a school district has to close a school and they do so, you know, even though the community members are very upset, they don't want that school closed. You know, for example, Robbinsdale just went through a very tough situation where they had to close a couple schools. And the parents, sometimes the parents and the families, it takes them a while to adjust to the idea of going to a new school, seeing how that settles out. I'm concerned if right away we have, and I think I have mentioned this before, but if we have a charter school that goes right into that spot, you know, with no break in between, that the path of least resistance will be that student will go right to the charter school. And so are we, you know, forcing an exodus when in some cases a district is just trying to, you know, rebuild and gain its strength?
Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff, I think there's two or three issues there that you've mentioned. One, I think in terms of a school that is closed by a traditional district, a charter school cannot open immediately. I mean, the process for creating a charter school and just getting approval and stuff is about an 18-month process. So in terms of somebody starting a charter school to fill in that spot immediately is virtually impossible under current processes. And also, if they want to start a charter school where there has been a closure, the law currently provides that there's a higher level of proof that is required that they are not starting a school because of a school closure. The second scenario, though, would be where there's a relocation of a school. And again, normally that is a 12-month process. People, because they have leases, people are not just going to jump to buildings if there's a vacant building that came up this year, if they have a lease that goes for 3 or 4 years. So I think there is a slightly different situation in both of those scenarios.
Madam Chair, Mr. Piccolo, but so for example, you know, this school in Robbinsdale closes and there's another charter school very close by that is expanding and chooses to, for the next September, go ahead and lease, you know, move, relocate, as you say. It could happen pretty quickly.
Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff, I think this bill still provides the district the option not to lease if they cannot come to arrangements in terms of the price and so forth.
Okay. I know in this bill that it also allows charter schools to use the state money to purchase, and Senator Hahn also had the A1 amendment, which we will not move today, but that you have in front of you that would include that that will also allow a charter school, a holding company, to purchase a school as well. One of the things, Mr. Piccolo, I'm wondering is that this amendment just basically opens the door to a charter school owning a building and there's no other reporting mechanism in place or any kind of sort of approval process. And I think that that's where, when we've looked at these holding companies, we've had a number of hours of testimony on that, trying to understand that right now there's sort of a gray area of who's the board, what's the relationship, how is lease aid being used, is the amount that a holding company is charging a charter school for lease, is it going to just pay for the cost of the lease, or are there times when the cost of the building is less than what they're charging the school, and is the holding company making a so-called profit and passing that on to pay for other expenses? So I think with this bill, what I'm sensing is that I would feel much more comfortable even, you know, opening the door to this if there was some additional information, a process for this happening. And when I've asked charter schools that have holding companies, how could we do this? What would be reasonable in terms of additional information or documentation? I've been basically told it works just fine the way it is. And that's, I think, where there's some frustration with that. Do you have some thoughts, Mr. Piccolo?
Yes, Senator Saltzman. We have proposed and are proposing and have proposed in the House legislation a certain requirements that a charter school cannot create a building company until they've been in existence at least 5 years. Because the first 5 years, they need to be focusing on building their program, getting their enrollment, and stabilizing the organization. And so, and not everybody should be owning a building, either through a building company or directly. And we would pose the school owning it directly. So we believe that there should be a five-year term before they can do that. It's like, because some schools are not going to ever be have the enrollment level and so forth where they can afford to have a mortgage, basically. It's very much like a homeowner. There are some people who should never own a building, a home, because they just don't have the income stream and so forth to own a building. So we say 5 years. We also have recommended that the sponsor has to approve the moving forward on a nonprofit affiliated building company, and as part of that review by the authorizer, that they need to, the school needs to have looked at all kinds of options, of facility options, including other leasing arrangements, potentially a nonprofit building company and so forth, and document all that. They have to do a financial projections, solid financial projections, be in solid condition financially themselves at the time they're moving forward, and also that they would have to show solid enrollment projections going forward, that they can show that there is the potential of enrollment to pay the bills based on that enrollment. So we have proposed some things to put some place, things in place to make it clear that this is not the path for everybody.
Okay. Do you believe, though, there is there should be some sort of approval process in advance? Because right now, a charter school can begin construction on a building through a holding company or a nonprofit organization. And there's really no paperwork that's exchanged with the department while the building is being constructed until the charter school basically shows up and requests lease aid. And I think that's where the public is wondering, how is it that a district school has to go through a very, very public process with this? And in a same community that may have buildings that are deteriorating and they can't pass a bond, they don't understand how a charter school receives dollars. Is there a potential for that being part of a proposal?
Senator Saltzman, we have proposed that the authorizer has to submit an affidavit before the school could go forward with creating the building company, which documents what the authorizer has done in terms of the review of all these issues I just mentioned. And then before they, when they do that, then they'd start the process of, you know, if they're going to use a bond house and so forth, and they'd have to go through all the due diligence of the bond houses required and the banks and so forth, which is an extensive process. And for those schools, that is a much more rigorous review of their finances than they've ever had to go through before. So there'd be basically a two-step process. They'd have to meet these conditions, get their sponsor's approval or authorizer's approval. The authorizer documents what they've done in due diligence and review of that. Then the school could move forward with the process, which then gets into the bonding houses, the mortgage, the banks, and so forth.
Do you think a review and comment that is similar to what a public school district would go through would be appropriate to request? Would there be a reason why we would not want to require that?
I think that's something we are open to looking at. I know the department has some concerns and issues with regard to that particular thing, as this has been debated over in the House.
There's a question from Senator Rummel.
Madam Chair, Mr. Piccolo, First of all, I appreciate the work that you do on behalf of charter schools and your strong advocacy. The last comment you made about Senator Salzman's question, what are the concerns that the department might have about having a review and comment?
Perhaps Mr. Brown would like to come forward and answer that. Although I'm sure, Mr. Piccolo, you may have a good idea what he's going to tell us.
Yes.
Morgan Brown with the Department of Education. Madam Chair and Senator Rummel, I think the department would certainly be happy to look at proposed language that would involve some kind of review process by the department and give feedback. I think the concern with regard to Senator Saltzman's specific question is having charter schools go through the very pretty extensive process and review that the department does when a school district is going to either build a public building or significantly expand a public building. It's a pretty extensive process and would probably end up resulting in a pretty substantial cost that would show up in a fiscal note for the department, because we currently don't have the staff resources to do that beyond what our responsibilities are currently.
So let me just ask before Senator Rummel has a question, is that why might the department not feel that it was appropriate that if we are using, because these are taxpayer dollars, one is going to be local taxpayer dollars, one is going to be general fund dollars essentially, why would we not have the same oversight? Should we not have that sort of oversight for a district school then, or what would be the difference?
Madam Chair, the department, I think we need to acknowledge that there's two different situations here, and of course currently this whole situation with the nonprofit building corporations isn't even really addressed in the law. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's a first step that we need to talk about, and then what would be the role of the department in actually reviewing it once the school has gone through the process that Mr. Piccolo has outlined. I think we do need to, even though there's public dollars involved in both, I think we do need to acknowledge there's a distinction between a school district building or expanding a public school building that's supported through local levies, and often that requires a vote, and that's going to be a public building, and if the school stops using it, it's going to continue to be a public building, and a situation with a charter school leasing what is essentially not a public space, is a private space. And so, for instance, let's say if a charter school closed and this was owned by a nonprofit building corporation, the state would not own the building. It would be the private bondholders that would take the loss on the building, essentially. So there is some distinctions. I'm not saying that it isn't appropriate for us to look at a review and comment process by the department, but whether it should be identical to the one we do for school districts, given that they're financing this often with local levies, and also that it's going to be a permanent public building, I think is something we just need to look into. And it would be a substantial staff resource issue for the department as well. So we just have some concerns. We're not necessarily opposed to it.
So follow from Senator Rummel.
I think, Madam Chair, you voiced my concern probably better than I can say it, but I a community has a capacity to educate so many children, and many of our traditional public schools, because of the way we fund them, have had to consolidate schools and create schools with class sizes that many parents find unacceptable simply because of the way we fund schools. And yet, using public monies, a charter school can open in the same district that has had to put their children in larger class sizes than they might want to, and then offer to folks another option out. And, the very, we cut the budget or trim the budget or squeeze the budget or whatever you want to say for traditional public schools, forcing them into decisions that they might not want to do. And then that opens the way, you know, if I had my children, yeah, I'd like them in a smaller school or smaller class size. So I think that the public review and the use of public dollars is really important. That we need to look at the capacity of a community to support another school. And if we have those dollars, wouldn't it be better to give all children smaller class sizes through a traditional school? That's my concern.
And a question from Senator Bonoff.
Madam Chair, I think what Senator Rummel is addressing is in some ways similar to my concern, where we set up a situation where, in fact, understandably, parents would choose leaving the public school because of what's available for a charter school. And that is, in some ways, the whole reason for being. You know, we know that we respect and value choice, and that's why we've created this option. But we aren't funding them in the same manner. And so I think we have to be careful that our decisions don't have unintended consequences. And with regard to the situation that I brought up about Robbinsdale, you know, there's they are now going through a lot of issues with some of their schools being racially isolated. And so that's causing a lot of concern for parents. And so if they have an opportunity to pick, oh, you know, in the same school that my child, you know, spent the last 3 years in, now this charter school is coming in and they don't have some of the same diversity issues and some of the problems that are associated with that, that would for sure be an easy choice. And so I don't think the answer is to legislate that, because we're going to look at that in, as we study integration aid, but it is a concern. So I don't have the answer, but
Senator Sullivan, I think both of the concerns that have been raised by both the senators are legitimate and really get into some larger issues about public school choice and the purpose of public school choice in Minnesota. And so I guess what I just want to say is I didn't want to try to load all that those issues onto the back of this particular issue about nonprofit building corporations and the appropriate way that they are approved and we have oversight of them. All of the issues that are being raised would be just as much of a potential issue if you had a charter school come in and lease space from a for-profit landlord as opposed to building a nonprofit building corp. So I'd like to, as we go forward, talk about the nonprofit building corp on with respect to the merits of that own situation and what kind of oversight is appropriate. Because one of the things we haven't talked about and we may want to explore, for instance, are there instances for when a charter school has a nonprofit building corporation and that lease is back to the charter school where there are some savings in terms of lease aid as opposed to a charter school just leasing from a for-profit landlord, the old issue of mortgage versus rent. So those are some other things that I think we need to put on the table as we discuss that going forward.
There are some other people here to testify, so I really appreciate, you know, that you're open to these discussions. And I would encourage anyone who's interested in this proposal to sort of reflect on what you've heard today, and that if you could bring some suggestions to us, that would be really helpful, because I think we've expressed that we'd like to have some additional reporting or some sort of system so that there it's very clear and transparent of how these building companies work. I believe Mr. Kronquist would like to testify. And is there anyone else? Please come to the table. And also Dr. Christensen. Mr. Kronquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Scott Kronquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. And Madam Chair, we do want to testify in opposition, actually, to this bill, to Senate File 718. And in fact, we actually, our position would be 180 degrees from this. We think that when there is a public school building that closes, that there should in fact be a cooling off period, so to speak, or a moratorium, whatever you want to call it, before a charter school would be allowed to come into that building. And this is in no way an anti-charter school position. It is all about fiscal responsibility, and it's about letting a very emotional process have a chance to settle down. I think, as you all know, when a school closes, it is a very emotional thing for the families involved, for the community involved. And the community needs some time to heal from that. The reason that school closed is because enrollment was down in that community, and they didn't no longer have the number of students to support a school in that neighborhood. And so we actually, Madam Chair, I don't have a specific proposal to offer you today, but be happy to work with you. But we think we actually need to think about some kind of, again, for lack of a better term, cooling off period before a district would even be allowed to allow a charter school to move into a building. Thank
okay.
you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Dr. Christensen and then Mr. Grathwald.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Christensen. I'm superintendent of Intermediate School District 917, and I'm here on behalf of the intermediates to share a couple of different perspectives. One is that we would love to have the first right of refusal on spaces that districts are declaring surplus or taking out of operations. We have programs, we have space needs, and we feel like that as a school district, if you will, intermediate school district, that we've always worked with our member districts and competed with other entities for those spaces. But if the option is there to give us a first right of refusal, we'd be happy to accept that as another amendment to this proposal, that we actually get in line ahead of some other entities. On the other side of it, another perspective is we are owners of spaces, and we do have times when we might be in the position of either selling or leasing. And the thing that's problematic for me is the term competitive offer. And the reason I bring that up is having just recently gone through the disposal of an old building and the building of a new building, the disposal process included getting appraisals of what is fair market value. And in this market right now, that is interesting to get an appraisal and then to actually go into the open market and seek proposals, much less than what it was appraised at. And to be real honest, it's hard to decide what is competitive and what is not. And so I think that particular description is very broad, and it would be hard to determine exactly what would be a competitive offer without some kind of definition to what that might be. So I see some issues here that maybe are, you know, unintended consequences, so to speak, with what seems like a fairly straightforward proposal that I think we need to think about and look at very carefully before we would move forward.
Very good. Any questions? And Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just curious, has there been an issue with you not having access to a building that is closed? I mean, is this, as they say, a solution in search of a problem? I mean, have you been closed out of a situation? Have you seen it go to somebody else that you think you weren't made aware that you would have bid for it?
Currently, our member districts have been cooperative in making us aware of options available to their facilities. However, they have to be good business people and be responsive to their citizens, and they look at what is the greatest amount of gain they can get for that investment. And so there have been times when it was a private entity was able to acquire a building because they were able to offer more resources than what we were able to put together as an intermediate. So there have been times when we are in an open market situation now without preferential treatment that we've not always been the choice of the lease of space or the sale of the space.
Thank you. Very good. And Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure if this is a question for the testifiers or committee. It's just a thought here. I'm not familiar with the District 917s in my corner of the world, but I think I understand conceptually what's going on. But my question is, if we have we have a building that's been vacated for whatever reasons, and it's been paid for by tax dollars, let's say, within the school system, and in the broader context of what we're looking at now with our fiscal problems, and we're talking about trying to reach across borders and do some collaborations. You know, it's the same concept of mutual aid, you know, between fire departments.
Take my bill.
Shouldn't we also be looking at the opportunity for
just
a local public university, like I live in Winona State or the Tech College, or the city, or the county, if they have facilities needs, somehow they should be in that loop, because otherwise they go out and, you know, build a whole new building for something that they could already maybe inhabit with just some remodeling, and the taxpayers have already paid for it. And instead of building new and starting all over with a multi-million dollar project, does anyone know if there's a mechanism to bring other government entities into the process before a tax-paid building moves onto the open market?
That's a very interesting point, Senator Erickson Ropes, and I'm not sure that there is anything, and that's why I think this particular bill spells out. I'm not sure if there is something in place if a public building is going to be exchanged or could like probably look into that, I think, with this whole concept of that. Perhaps,
Madam Chair, and Senator Erickson-Ropes, there's nothing included in the schoolhouse closing section, but in the uses of schoolhouse, the board may authorize the use of any schoolhouses in the district for divine worship, Sunday schools, public meetings, elections, post-secondary institution, and other community purposes that in its judgment will not interfere with their use for school purposes. So this is something that might happen on in the evenings or on the weekends, but it doesn't have that same it's permissive language, and it doesn't, and that language isn't included in a school closing section.
Well, Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Gray. I think maybe that's something we can consider as the legislature to look at, not only as school district buildings close, but as the county closes a building, maybe there's a need for that building within a university system or the city. We should be looking at all of these public assets across boundaries, it seems to me.
Senator Bonner?
Madam Chair, Senator Erickson-Ropes, I think you make a wonderful point, and I was, as you were talking, I was thinking we should have an asset management strategy, and there should be oversight and regulation, and these are our properties, and so I think if Senator Han were here, he would actually like the direction this conversation was going, and he would be supportive, but we'll talk to him, because I think perhaps we're premature in making the first right of refusal go to one entity without having a broader strategy about asset management.
Well, Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Madam Chair, thank you, Senator Bonhoeff, and not knowing where the answer to that question was, perhaps I'll pursue that beyond this committee, though.
That would be excellent.
Thank you.
And Dr. Christensen.
Madam Chair, committee members, if I could just kind of comment on the discussion you've just had. We just recently finished a project where a former school site was sold to the Dakota County Community Development Agency for senior and low-income housing development. And the site we purchased for our new school was from the county, which was a surplus maintenance shop building. And through permissive legislation, we were able to negotiate those sales. And I'm not sure they would have all met the competitive offer standards that might be determined in this particular bill. So there's an example of interagency or intergovernmental cooperation that may not have, that would benefit at all, but was not necessarily might meet the market standards of what would be considered competitive.
Very good. Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Madam Chair, and thank you very much for that example. Maybe I'll have to talk with you later about getting some of those examples, because I think what I'm talking about here is what you're suggesting is it may only make sense that we move away from a competitive open market process, since this is all we're all talking about public services here and taxpayer dollars, no matter which government unit you're in. Thank you.
So just something from Dr. McQuaid. She has something else she'd like to share with us on lease space.
Madam Chair, the one other limitation that charter schools face as opposed to other government entities is that they're required to, their limitations are such that they move into buildings that are school ready to a certain degree. And I don't think that other governmental entities would have those similar restrictions.
Very good. And Mr. Grathwohl, you've just been promoted.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Jim Grathwohl. I'm the lobbyist for Minneapolis Public Schools, and I don't even play a doctor on TV, so I don't know how that could have happened. I'd like to testify in opposition to Senate File 718. I think there isn't a state interest in real estate transactions of school districts, and I think I could happily come up here and testify in opposition to a bill that was the converse, where a bill that was prohibiting school districts from selling to charter schools. And, you know, so sometimes it's good to have a thought experiment to put the shoe on the other foot. I think this is a solution or a problem looking for a solution looking for a problem. Is that what I'm looking for? In Minneapolis, we have excess properties. In one round of putting out RFPs for that, the Minneapolis School Board decided, you know, we don't want to entertain any offers from charter schools. today, we've sold one site to a charter school. So that was then, this is now. Today, we are in the process, we've sold one site to a charter school and are in the process of negotiating sales to two more. There are other elected officials who can solve this problem, and those are your school board members. And I think this is an appropriate problem for them to wrestle with. Dr. Christensen was talking about land deals in Minneapolis. The whole land deal is a complex thing. We're negotiating with our Park and Rec Board, with the city, and with public RFPs on how to dispose of the property. I think you're probably better off letting school boards address this issue, and they'll do that wisely. There may be a learning curve, but I think you're best off trusting your school boards on this one.
Because Senator Hein is not here today, I do want to say that one of the things about this bill that I think is that I think we need to think about is that there's concerns that charter schools are going out and building new schools because they can't find space. This is sort of another approach to that. But I think that you've just expressed a very important point that at some point school boards, it works, but they perhaps need a cooling off period. Being able to assess a situation and having charter schools come in for reason of this is a new program, then we're just going to put a school in the same place because the families want one. I think there's trying to walk the fine line between the difference of that. Ms. Kelleher and Ms. Alzweiger, would you like to testify?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Good morning, committee members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. We are opposed to this bill. Been part of a school board who had to shut down a school, and I hope you understand the magnitude of that decision for not only the school board members but for the community. It's a very, very difficult process, and oftentimes the reason is if you actually want to make sure you have a budget decision that is lasting through the years, closing a building is one way to assure that, and it's not taken on lightly. Certainly, by letting charter schools have the option of first refusal, you're allowing them first of all, they aren't allowed to own buildings now, and second of all, you're allowing them to be the first one in line. And I want to suggest to you that, as Senator Erickson Ropes mentioned, there's a lot of community partnerships go on. A lot of times the school district will build a community center and actually share part of that building. So there's lots of other intermediate steps and uses for that building that the district looks at, and to put a charter school in first before cities, counties, or the state seems to be inappropriate at this time.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Alzweiger.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, excuse me, Jan Alzweiger, Education Minnesota. I'm going to take a little different approach as I talk about this, and I know that in these tough economic times, we have to make really tough decisions. In our regular E-12 schools, higher ed, I should say traditional public schools, are facing some very difficult financial times ahead. We know that school districts across the state are going to be cutting teachers, they're going to be cutting staff, they're going to be closing buildings, they're going to be reducing grade levels, they're going to be increasing class sizes. So why, this is the irony, why would we be looking at starting more charter schools? And I know this is about buildings, but in order to start charter schools, you need buildings. So we're going to close buildings and then start up charter schools. It just seems too ironic, and I think that at this point, all traditional public schools and all charter public schools should be in this economic situation together and have to deal with this problem. In the governor's budget, we see $2 million for startups for charter schools. I cannot figure that out. You pair that piece with this legislation, and you have spelled out a disaster for a number of school districts that are closing buildings. So I wanted to take it a little different direction because this bill has a bigger impact this year than it would have in previous years, which is, I think, why you have a lot more people with a lot more emotions and energy talking about this. I would encourage you to consider putting a moratorium on charter schools rather than looking at expansions, dealing with these facility issues. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. And we have one last testifier, and then I'd like to move on because we have a number of other bills. But I think we've had some good discussion on this issue.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I'm Carolyn Jackson with the American Civil Liberties Union of Minnesota. And as you may know, we have a lawsuit pending right now. It's a taxpayer lawsuit, which looks at a charter school. And one of the big issues is the use of the lease aid in our lawsuit. And in our investigation, this is not particularly relevant to the language of this language, but of this bill. But when we're talking about these holding companies, Mr. Piccolo mentioned mortgage versus lease. In the language that I have seen about the holding companies, I'm not seeing an end of the lease payments. When you pay off your mortgage, you no longer make payments. And I just want to raise the issue that if these holding companies are created to build buildings for charter schools, there has to be a sunset provision, because otherwise it goes to the last testifier saying that then charter schools will get more money than a traditional public school from the state, because the building is paid for and the lease aid then becomes additional aid for the holding company. And then the holding company has the choice of putting it back into the school or funneling it off to something else. But we have to look at scarce public dollars and how they're being used. And if we allow these holding companies without a sunset provision to the lease, like a mortgage, then we're looking at sort of a disparity of use of public funds.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you.
Madam Chair, Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership, and I had not intended to testify, but maybe it's not so much specifically to this bill, but some of the legislation I think we can anticipate, particularly given some of the comments. And you're in a very difficult place trying to decide. A school is closed, which, as Ms. Kelleher mentioned, is a very emotional and difficult issue. And whether or not people are trying to start a new school just to replace the one that was closed, or that there may be people that have a charter school that would like that facility because it's an upgrade from where they are. And they are serving already a population of students. So you're trying to decide sometimes, you know, is the charter school that's looking at that facility there just because they want to replace the one that was closed, or is it because it's a charter school that can better serve their students by being in that facility? And I guess my overall message, somewhat for this bill, but also as you go forward in thinking about charter schools and whether or not we have moratoriums and caps and things like that, is not to so much get into a conversation about this deliverer of public education versus that deliverer of public education, but how can we best serve the needs of the students? And I think Senator Erickson Ropes was on that a little bit in terms of we have public service providers, and how can we set up structures that will best result in this case, students being served, as opposed to a provider versus a provider approach. So I guess that's the gist of my comments this morning, and I appreciate your time.
Madam Chair, Morgan Brown with the Education Department. Just one very quick point of clarification regarding the previous testifier. The question that she brought up is a legitimate one about should lease payments continue to be made after a building has been paid off, but I wanted to point out that's not limited to circumstances with nonprofit building corporations. And for instance, we have charter schools that lease space from school districts, and they pay the market rate lease payment whether or not the school district has paid off that building as well. So it's something we need to address across the board.
Yes, thank you very much. Mr. Breifogel, would you like to add something? I know you're going to be up very soon here testifying on another bill.
Could I just make one comment on this?
Yes, interesting.
Okay. And it's Vin McMahon.
Vin, I'm sorry. Mr. McMahon, I'm sorry.
That's
I have
right.
both of you confused.
Madam Chairwoman, members of the committee, I was on the board of a charter school, and we did deal with this issue of creating a separate, it was called MIX, and it was supposed to be a nonprofit company, and the money was supposed to flow from the state to pay for the lease aid money came in. And MIX was going to charge $1 per square foot more And the argument made at the board by the executive director, and we were told that this was all legal, that this was a way to funnel money into other uses that the school could use, where the money normally coming in from the state, we wouldn't be allowed to use it. So I just wanted to get that on the record. And also, I also have a slightly different perspective, perhaps, because I was in the municipal bond industry dealing with financing for 25 years. And if you look at there's a world of difference between bonds that are issued by existing school districts and charter schools. They would be considered revenue bonds. And there would be no recourse against taxpayers through the charter school, and they would be considered junk bonds, extremely risky investments. And you can always find somebody to underwrite those types of issues. In fact, that whole issue came up at the charter school where I was on the board, and they investigated that. And so I think there's a great potential there for it, the issuance of bonds that will work for a while, but then as the quality of the schools go down, the state is going to be left holding the bag. So I thank you for allowing me to make comments.
Absolutely. Well, I think we need to do some more work on this. I would like to move Senator Hand's bill so that it is on the table so that when we come back on Wednesday that it's been treated like the other bills today. So I'd like to move Senate File 718. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. And the motion prevails.
Sorry.
I'd also like to move the A1 amendment from Senator Hand that, that includes the language that would add on line 17, after schools insert 501c3 charter school property holding companies, and the same on page 1, line 19. Discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign, and the motion prevails. Senator Wieger, I wonder if you would move to lay this bill on the table and for possible inclusion in our charter school bill. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign, and the motion prevails. All right. Thank you very much. I would now like to go to Senate File 554, which is my bill, and it is a bill that I had drafted in response to hearing as we had discussion from a number of teachers, and as our working group, both in the House and Senate, became known, I was contacted, as some of you have, by a number of different people with letters of support, concern, whatever, regarding charter schools. And I did receive some letters and phone calls from teachers and school board members who have been on charter schools and felt that there should be an opportunity for protection of charter school teachers or employees who express concerns with operations, finances, etc. And as a result, that is Senate File 554, which is in front of you. So I would like to move Senate File 554 at this time. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. All right. I'd like to call up the three witnesses today to just sort of share their stories of their experience and just for us to have a sense of the purpose behind this bill. Essentially that in a charter school, because they are away from a lot of different requirements, there have not been contracts. There is a statement that charter schools may discharge teachers and non-licensed employees, period. There's no reason for cause. And so this particular additional language would add that a school may not discharge, discipline, threaten, otherwise discriminate against, or penalize an employee regarding their compensation, terms, conditions, locations, or privileges of employment because the employer person has acted on behalf of, because they have reported concerns about the finances, the financial irregularities, instructional concerns, conflicts of interest, or other violations of law. So I wonder at this time if Mr. Breifogel and Mr. McMahon and Ms. Cooper-Lyle would like to come forward and just share a little bit about their experience and why we might want to consider this bill.
Yes. Madam Chair, committee members, good morning. My name is Judy Cooper-Lyle. I'm a theater director in South Minneapolis, Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today regarding my former employer, the Minnesota Internship Center Charter School. I was a teacher with MNIC from the fall of 2004 until the spring of 2007. I was laid off from the school with a two-line email from Kevin Byrne, the school's director, in the summer of 2007. The reason given was financial, although I know it was because I questioned Mr. Byrne's activities and the way the school was run. I opened the satellite school site at Sabathney Community Center in the summer of 2005, with the focus being the performing arts. I've been involved in the performing arts in inner city Minneapolis for 35 years, and it was through my negotiations and my relationship with Sabathney Community Center that the school got a foothold there. During my time with the school, I involved 35-plus young people in four major productions, dance classes, theater classes, and visual arts. I'm qualified to run such a program because I hold a valid license in theater arts. One teacher at the Sabathney site is not licensed. Although not a licensed teacher, she has her own classroom and teaches all subjects, which is what all teachers with the Minnesota Internship Center are required to do, even subjects in which they are not licensed. Mr. Byrne told the staff that the credits turned in by teachers at the end of each semester would be signed off when submitted by teachers who held the proper certification, even though the teachers who signed off on the grades were not in the classroom teaching those particular subjects. During my time there, the school had no textbooks. I had to utilize books from home, supplies I often purchased myself, and lesson plans gleaned off the internet. Although holding my teaching license only in theater and visual arts, I taught history, math, science, and English, none of which I was qualified or certified to do. Although called an internship center, with one of the major goals being to actually establish internships for credit and experience for the students at workplaces, during the time I was there, I know of only two actual internships that were set up for students. The person who was to be in charge of finding internships was a friend of Byrne's who worked on contract and visited the classroom on rare occasions. Most computers do not work. Students have a myriad of problems, including shifting from one school to another, suspension from other schools, trouble with the law, being single parents, among other things. And while it is a wonderful idea to provide a school setting for these students, there are no social workers or licensed counselors working for the school. At least there weren't when I was there. The school is so desperate for more students, because more students mean more money, that at one point Mr. Byrne was promising a full credit to students who could bring a friend or relative to school and keep them there for 30 days. I knew of many students who received credits this way. The year after my husband died, I asked to be put on half-time assignment. I suggested to Mr. Byrne that I teach in the fields for which I was licensed and that another teacher teach half-time in the other subjects. He said we would do this beginning in the fall. However, for several months, I worked full-time but was paid for half-time work because another teacher was not hired and I didn't want to leave the students without a teacher. When another teacher was finally brought in, Byrne separated the students according to the ones he considered trouble and gave those students to me. That was all right with me because I had formed a relationship with them, but the way it was accomplished was humiliating to me and to the students and left them feeling branded. The change came about abruptly in the middle of the day and in front of another teacher and other students. I was moved to another classroom along with these so-called trouble students, who then were not allowed in certain parts of the building, and Byrne told the community center where we rented space that these students were essentially persona non grata. MNIC is poorly administrated, and huge changes need to be made with regard to its operations. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. McMahon or Mr. Breifogel?
Madam Chair, Committee, my name is John Breifogel. I was a teacher at MNIC for 3+ years. And a similar situation, there were some questions that arose about the management of funds, how you could go from a $440,000 plus to $200,000 missing in a few months. And I became a board member pursuing these and trying to ask these questions. Mr. Burns made a decision to get rid of a para who was servicing our ELL. The school where I worked was primarily ELL. Probably 60% were within the country less than a year. And we had a paraprofessional who was very adept and qualified to address these people. Because of some of the things that he was questioning, he was put on a list of fire. When I went to be there as a witness, I was also told that I would was going to be fired. I informed Mr. Byrne that he did not have the authority to fire, that it was belonged to the board members. And he said, no, you're fired, and that means you're off the board. What does that mean? To me, we have a kind of a catch-22 here. With the charter schools, teachers have to be on you have to have five teachers on the board. But if the teachers don't have some sort of protection where they have at least the same protection as given by statute 122A40 for tenured teachers, then if you de facto give all the power to the executive director, he can fire you and manipulates the board to the point where the board is so dysfunctional now that people won't talk to each other. Response is given, I can't talk to you, I've got a mortgage. So it's a big power play. In reading this, I see that this SF-554 here would have been beneficial because in looking at these, been informed by Mr. Hartman at the Department of Education, that since these administrators don't have licenses, they don't need to concur with the code of ethics. They're not held accountable to that. Also, the way the whistleblower works, you have to turn over information before your job is protected. I was fired trying to procure information and understand answers. So I think this bill goes a long way in giving some kind of legal recourse in case people suffer the same situation that I did. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next testifier.
Okay.
Now it's my turn. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for letting us speak today. I was a member of the board of the school board at MNIC, and I only became a teacher about 5 years ago. So I loved teaching, and I was very much interested in this whole charter school movement and what was going on. So when the opportunity came to get on the board, I thought it would be interesting. And as I mentioned earlier, while I'm not a financial expert, I do have a financial background. So I thought I could help fulfill the role on the board of looking after the finances and having a fiduciary relationship to look after the best interests of the students. From the time I was on the board, I consistently asked questions for further explanations about the finances of the school. And I never had a sense that I was being given full and complete information. There was also this whole issue of governance and the role of the board and our responsibilities that was never really explored or never really established. And part of it was a transition period where you have this board of friends, and then after a number of years, you have to have this elected board. So we were in that time moving to this different group of people on the board. I was elected board chair in June at our June meeting. So I was a board chair for half of the June meeting. And we had a meeting August 4th. At that meeting, I had gotten information from the Humphrey Institute and other sources regarding board governance. And the whole focus of future meetings, and we had scheduled one for August 20th, was to deal with the rights, the duties, the responsibilities, the fiduciary obligations of the board in their relationship with the executive director and other administrators and their responsibilities, and really going more completely and more openly into the finances of the school. I can only tell you that by coincidence, on August 20th, when we had another board meeting scheduled to deal with these precise issues, in fact, I downloaded and copied a stack of papers dealing with board governance issues, and the meeting was supposed to be about let's brainstorm as a group of people to figure out what we want to do as a school. Let's look at our rights and responsibilities at what we can do. But that meeting never occurred because 20 minutes before that meeting, I was fired from the school. And I was also handed a letter telling me that I was removed from the board. And that's all I have to say.
Yes, Senator Saltzman.
Yes, I guess that, you know, I'm sure that this is not just an isolated incident, but I'm also not, you know, suggesting that this is happening in a large percentage of our charter schools. But I think that as we have heard incidents of fiscal mismanagement, some of the issues regarding licensing, is that, and we've also heard of substitute teachers who have been in some schools, that there be a way that you know, a teacher who is there for all the right reasons to make sure that kids are achieving, to really follow out on the mission that you really believed in with this school, have some way of reporting back when taxpayer dollars are not being used or when children are not receiving the instruction that they should. And this is, and I understand too that there's always going to be you know, conflicts between administration and possibly teachers, and that there should be healthy debate. But I think that if we were to be able to really pinpoint this as to the policies that right now, and this is, I think, why we have a working group right now, is because we've had incidents that have tarnished many good charter schools. Mm-hmm. And is there a way so that teachers who are originally when this law was, you know, really created, was about teacher-operated schools, you know, teachers being able to use their creativity. It's not about a nonprofit leader. It's about teachers who have seen great strategies and innovations being able to have a greater part in their schools. And yet, if you have someone running a school who may not even have a license in education, being able to control, and I think that your situation of where you're on the board and yet your boss can fire you is very difficult. So that is the purpose for bringing this forward, is to be able to look at that.
Sarah Bach.
If I could.
Mr. Chair.
Sarah Bach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate this bill, and I support the language and the intent of the bill, but I think that it doesn't really get at the heart of the problem, which is the governance structure. And I saw Ms. Randall walk in, and I know that she talked about that, but I think that while the intent of creating the board structure was good in terms of giving teachers this opportunity to run a school, I think a board in its nature has to have the ability to oversee the CEO, so to speak, and that when you have teachers who report to the CEO, you cannot also expect them to manage that person, because you cannot run an organization that way. So I would hope that this session that we do deal with that problem, that that has to be fixed.
Senator Saltzman?
You know, on that point, I think that there are some pieces coming out in the bill that I have been working on to look at the governance structure. But I think still, when you look at how charter schools are run, it's that it's to give teachers more involvement with the school. But any employee, I mean, that, and I think what this bill goes back to is that this is not about there's some disruption, but if they're talking about potential fraud, if they're asking questions about finances, and obviously this can all be debated, what was the real reason for a person being dismissed, but I think when you hear situations like this where there has been pushback, or it happens as well, I think, with, you know, parents who are on a charter school who ask, you know, the director, as parents get more involved, they're all of a sudden they're labeled a difficult parent. because they're asking questions. And that's where I think with some of the charter schools, they are started by a group of people who have, it's a control issue, and they are a public school, and there's an election.
Senator Bach.
Mr. Chair and Senator Saltzman, I agree with you, and I think this is an important bill, and I look at it like it's whistleblower protection, and I think that's important. I would also say that we should do something pretty dramatic with regard to governance structures, and I think as we look at the problems right now in our economy and the corporations that have not delivered to the shareholders what they promised, much of that can go back to that the board becomes just a stamp of approval because they are under the thumb of the top officer. And so I think we have to address that.
Thank you. Mr. McMahon, I believe you had a question. We'll take one other. And
I was just going to say that it seems to me if you're taking the public school model and someone starting a charter school is really just duplicating that model and using a vertical integration authority structure, that you're missing the whole point of teacher involvement and teacher creativity. I mean, like I say, I have not been in education that long, but I have never met a teacher who wasn't completely dedicated to their students. And so there has to be more of a horizontal model of inclusiveness where you're taking the best interests of the students and you're somehow involving the professionals who work with those students every day, the teachers, right? Not the administrators, because they're normally removed from that involvement. You know, if they choose to be. Now, your comment about being many fine charter schools, I'm sure that there are. My fear is that that's the exception and not the rule.
Thank you, Mr. McMahon. Mr. Breufogel?
Chair, committee members, I would like to respond to what Senator Bonhoff was talking about, and I think that's the gist of the big catch-22 in the governance here. And I think it goes hand in hand with the idea of protecting teachers' rights. If you just take statute 122.840, I believe I'm quoting the correct one, it says when a teacher is going to be removed from their position that they have a chance to present their case, that it be heard by the board, and if they extend that at least to the board members, you're going to force some sort of a horizontal debate. It won't just be power structures. And I think that's something that could be maybe added to this. And then you're going to be meeting the spirit of the law, as I understand it, that you are getting education-focused alternatives and not just small business-focused education. So you'll be looking at that governance issue. You're going to be protecting some of those teachers who step up to address serious issues. And at a time when there's money problems, that local governance is the essential part. Because there is really, from my experience, the sponsoring agency and the MDE both turned it back on the board. We can't do anything. It's the board's responsibility.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Allswager, and is there anyone else that would like to testify?
Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate the effort you're putting into this.
Thank you. If others wishing to testify could please approach. And Ms. Allswager.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jan Allswager, Education Minnesota. And we would support this bill. And while I don't even know if we have any charter school members at this time, we have in the past. We are not advocating that, you know, this something be easier for Education Minnesota to organize members. That is not what we're doing. All we want is to have teachers, whether they are in the regular public schools or traditional schools or charter schools, be treated fairly. And I also just want to bring up the fact that, you know, we have the continuing contract law in the regular public schools, and people often call it tenure. It's really continuing contract. And I want to, this kind of illustrates why continuing contract is important. All it means is that a teacher continues their contract and has a right to due process if they are accused of something, and so that there is just cause for termination. And it really is what we're hearing about today. What you get with continuing contract, and we're not proposing that that become in the charter statute, but what you get is a teacher who is able to express their professional opinion without a threat of losing their job. For example, as a teacher, I could speak freely in an IEP meeting about what I felt a student needed to have in their best interest for their education. I feel that in some of the situations that were discussed just recently, that these people would be afraid to express their professional opinion for fear of losing their job. I could list a whole number of other situations, but I think it's important to realize that if a teacher is to do their very best in their profession, they have to be able to exercise their opinions for the benefit of the kids. And my heart goes out to these individuals who were doing their best as a professional teacher and as a result lose their jobs. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Halswager. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Sandra Hall. Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for letting us testify. I started teaching in 1965. Unlike Vin, I've been teaching all of my life. I retired from the St. Paul schools in 2002, so most of my experience has been what was described here, under the public school system, where if I wished to speak out, I had protections to do so. In 2003, a colleague of mine and I were asked by Mr. Byrne to help establish the English Language Academy site, which is one of the five sites of MNIC, because we had created a similar program called Leap English Academy under the St. Paul Public Schools. So we had some experience in setting up such a place. So for me, I was very vested in this because it's my baby, as it were. And we moved to a new site after a couple of years in an old one, and I had the best room I've ever had in my entire career, a palace, a penthouse, and the best students. And so I loved my job. But when this began happening this fall, when I returned from Europe to emails about this, I thought, this is like a bad dream. This is like a nightmare, because I came out of the public school system where such a thing would not have been possible. And as it went on with the fall, with one person after another being fired, and coincidentally all being board members, all being people who had spoken out, I thought, I think if I stay here now, I'm going to be condoning that sort of behavior. And I know we can't legislate ethics, but this was ethically dysfunctional. And so for the first time in my career, I quit in the middle of a semester. Students rioted. Ambulances had to be called. Fire trucks came. People were so upset. I quit, and I told students, I didn't give details because I'm a professional person. I said, things are going on here that I don't like, and if you can't fully commit to what's going on at a place, it's probably better that you leave. And I left. I now volunteer at another charter school 3 days a week because I'm not ready to quit working. But I couldn't work in that situation because it was so ethically wrong. And I thought, if I stay here, I will condone this kind of behavior. So I saw good people like this who spoke up and who were immediately fired. The thing that tripped me was when one of my colleagues, whom I have known from his days with us in the St. Paul Public Schools, was escorted out of his classroom in front of students by security people. When he had been told that he would have lost his job that Friday, but they came in the middle of the week, I thought, okay, that's it. I'm finished. So I think this legislation will do a great deal to protect people who would like to take the risk of stepping outside the public school system for a certain community of people who may need the charter school experience, and that those people need protection to be able to do that creative thing and to be able to speak up when things are wrong. Charter schools are a good idea. I didn't think I'd ever say that, having been in the public schools all those years. But they are a good idea. But a few bad apples, to use a terribly cliched response, are spoiling it for what is a very good movement. And I think that we need the protections of this bill, and I think we need some restructuring of how the whole thing is governed as well. Thank you for letting me speak.
And thank you, Ms. Hall, for your service and testimony. Senator Saltzman.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move this bill to be laid on the table.
Senator Saltzman, I was going to suggest that I support certainly the spirit of it. I thought maybe we could add the words, if you make such a report in good faith. And I think that's generally, you know, standard for making these types of reports, that it's done in good faith. But I could ask counsel or staff if they'd like to respond. And then I have some suggested language, if that's
Absolutely.
Your pleasure.
Mm-hmm. I agree with, Mr. Chair, members. I do agree with Senator Weger that adding a good faith clause to this would probably keep it consistent with other employment statutes within the statutes.
So I would be very open to that, Mr. Chair, perhaps we could work on an amendment if it's laid on the table.
We have it right here,
have
actually.
It right here. Very good. I would be very
open like
to that.
If you'd like to consider, Senator Saltzman moves at line 1.17, after employee, comma, insert acting in good faith, and further on that line, after the word acting, insert in good faith, and that would address the concern that we just addressed, and keep it in mind that's our intent to lay this over where we can further discuss it. Discussion on the amendment? All in favor indicate aye.
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 Carried. Senator Saltzman, you have a motion?
I'd like to move this to be laid on the table, Mr. Chair.
As amended.
As amended. Thank you, Senator Rummel.
Okay. Further discussion? Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you. I just have one question. I was out of the room. I apologize. But what is MNIC? I don't know what that is.
Senator Saltzman.
So, Mr. Chair, MINC is the Minnesota Internship Center. It's MIX. So it's MN Minnesota Internship Center.
MIX is the holding company that
they... Okay.
And there is a holding company that that holds... that is used to lease facility space.
Okay.
Senator Saltzman renews her motion. All in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Saltzman. And again, thank you to all the testifiers.
And at this time, I'd like to call Senator Scheid forward. And we have three bills left, and I it's not that I don't want to give them adequate time, but we have heard from several of the groups previous to this about generally their proposals, and so we'd like to be able to go through them and then really have time for some questions. We'll have limited testimony on these bills because I think that we've also heard some testimony in the past as well, but I will sort of like to look at these three different bills because they do have different language, kind of the same sections of statute. So, Senator Scheid, thank you for being here. Thank you for carrying this bill. And, Mr. Piccolo, welcome back.
Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, I'm sorry I missed the beginning of the meeting. I don't know what your intention is.
Yes, let me go over that, Senator Scheid.
I was in another meeting. So.
Yes, we have five bills today, and they're all being laid on the table, and especially these last three bills because they are all different approaches to the same areas of statute. One is your bill, which is coming forward from the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools. A second bill is from Education Evolving. The third bill is the agency bill. And we're laying those on the table. And the next Wednesday at 3 o'clock, this group will reconvene. And I will be introducing and using the agency bill, which is the companion, which is the bill being used in the House for their charter school bill. So we have a companion bill. And we'll be plucking some things out of all of these bills to roll something out from this subcommittee to our full education committee. And as I mentioned to members, we've spent about 2 months on this subject. We've had a number of meetings, and we would like to present to the full committee, or I would like to recommend that we present to our full committee sort of a broad bill with a number of different options in them so that they're able to hear the discussion, because I think there's been a lot of questions. Can, you know, what about this? What about that? How might we present something to them that's a package? It may go further than we would like in the end, but it gives people some choices of how we might be able to address some of the concerns and the opportunities that have been brought forward. And I also mentioned that our intent is to strengthen charter schools, so there is always going to be strong support from the public and addressing some of the transparency and accountability issues that a small percentage of schools have caused concern.
So, Madam Chair, you're planning to carry the bill.
I was planning to carry the agency bill, and because it's the bill being used in the House as their vehicle.
That's fine. I just wanted to know that you and I hadn't talked personally about that, and I just wanted to understand that. We have a good bill for you there then. And, you know, 1991 was the last year that I spent in the other body. And I don't even remember if I voted for it. I'm thinking at the time I might not have. I don't remember. I was really nervous about it. It was really cutting edge. And as you know, it was first charter school legislation authorization in the country. And it was a Democratic legislature and a Republican governor who worked together on that. And so I really see it as a very, very bipartisan, nonpartisan kind of issue. And I think it's important to have that perspective. I am one of the strongest advocates of public education that I know. I'm not bragging. I'm just telling you I really believe in public education. And I know that charter schools are public education. I think we, however, in the legislature and maybe out in the public differentiate it and think it isn't public school, but it is. But it took a Governor Carlson. He was never, you know, I served with him in the Minnesota House, actually, at one time, dating both of us. We weren't dating, but we So, you know.
Thank you for clarifying.
It's a long time ago. I'm sure he'll appreciate it as well. Anyway, you know, I just thought he was kind of a tough-nosed character, and I sat in a meeting with him over something entirely different. I'm in the Senate. It was the 90s, and I just was defending public schools and funding, and it didn't have to do with charters, but he made a point with me that has stuck with me. And, you know, we often say, we all say, parents are the most important factor. If not, I think they are the most, but certainly one of the most important factors in the success or not of a child's education and a child's achievement. Well, that just begs you to say then, parents having a right to choose where their children go to school is pretty fundamental to that perspective. And so I became a believer, and I finally understood what choice meant. And I also believe that it can improve education at all levels if parents do have a choice. And so we have seen the newspaper TV stories of charter schools having troubles. By the way, I don't know, I think maybe possibly I'm still paying on property taxes at my cabin for the misdeeds of a public school official. Okay? It was one individual. It wasn't a system, but things go wrong at all levels, in all sectors, segments of our society. And so, but these garner headlines, and people have become concerned. So we have a bill that, and I shouldn't say we, because I didn't help draft it, and I, as you know, I'm no longer on the Education Committee, and that is heartbreaking to me, but it's still, you know, my number one concern as a legislator. And so what we're doing, I've heard you talking earlier in the discussion of other bills about accountability. It's extremely important. And I think this bill addresses those in a comprehensive way. And Mr. Piccolo is going to help me or take us through the detail of the bill. I'm sure you want to do that. We're strengthening the oversight processes and the oversight procedures in a number of areas. And then we want to enhance charter school innovation and operations and the governance of them. Obviously, these are issues with mm-hmm. which you're dealing. So we're here with, I think, some really carefully thought out approaches or an approach to do that. And would you mind?
Sure.
Yeah, okay.
So, Mr. Piccolo.
Madam Chair, members, if you want to walk through the bill then?
Absolutely. But perhaps, like, just to just to respond that, you know, those are excellent points, Senator Scheid. And I think that if you had heard, especially our testimony in the first three meetings that we had, we really focused on the history of charter schools, what has been accomplished, but also acknowledged that for 15 years, just as there has been hesitancy at the beginning, over the past probably 5 years that I've sort of been hovering around here at the Capitol, there's been a hesitancy that any time we have tried to address some oversight issues or start to look at could we tweak some of these things, there's been a response of, well, you're like, you don't support charter schools. And I think as a result of that, of not really going back and looking at what could we do now that we have a much larger, from like what 10 schools originally to about 150 much larger schools, what kind of oversight, what kind of issues, and how can we also strengthen the system? So I think that's the intent here, and I know Max has worked on that as well. So thank you for being here, and we do miss you on the E-12 committee very much.
And Madam Chair, I did not mean to imply that anybody who had a different opinion didn't support charter schools, although I know there are people who do not. Mm-hmm. And so I'm concerned about that, but we do, and we're here with what we think is a really responsible mm-hmm. approach to the issues that have come up.
Very good. Mr. Piccolo.
Madam Chair and members, just a little background. We started looking at this issue 2 years ago on the 15th anniversary of the law and said, you know, it's 15 years, and there's never been a complete look at the whole law, and that we need to look at every component. And so we had a committee working for 2 years that looked line by line through the legislation and said, what do we need to address? Where are there problems that continue to arise, or where are there concerns continue to arise? And that we needed to look at this in a systematic way, because if you just fix one little thing, you create other problems, and you need to look at it in the big picture. So this proposal is a result of that comprehensive look. The first thing in subdivision one, there's just some language to clarify the purposes of charter schools. There are six purposes from the original law, and just to make it clear, it's about, you know, one of them is to improve people learning and achievement, that it's about growth and not just where it's at. So that's just to clarify that. The subdivision 2A is to reestablish a charter school advisory council that would help guide the transition in the processes that are proposed in here. And one thing I would like to also say, I should set up front, is all the recommendations that we have included in here reflect recommendations also from the legislative auditor report. So we've taken a very serious look at that, and they were very in their process, they interviewed sponsors and schools and did a lot of research themselves that reinforced things that we were looking at already. So it clarifies what the role of that council would be and sunsets it in 2015. Subdivision 3 starts the major reform of charter schools. The first in subdivision 3, it's line 227, it changes who can be a authorizer. It makes it clear that houses of worship or churches cannot be authorizers. And I should have gone back to line 223. We changed the language in this bill from sponsor to authorizer. And it is not just a word change that's done lightly. It is to send a clear message that people understand sponsor as somebody that puts money into something, or that, you know, in terms of AA or something, there's somebody that holds your hand. And authorizer says, no, this is an oversight, this is an authority role, that this group of people, this organization that has the role of chartering and authorizing, has a role of authority over that school to make sure there is accountability. And it's not just somebody holding your hand and being your buddy. Their job is to hold you accountable. And so the language change is very important, and you will see that through the whole legislation.
So to disappoint, Mr. Piccolo, we heard a lot of your legislative platform earlier.
Yes.
So if you could really focus on pinpointing some of this so that we have time for questions,
okay,
that would be really helpful.
In 3.8, this is where the establishes a process for authorizers to be approved. Currently, authorizers do not have to demonstrate capacity or competence to do authorization. All they have to do is meet one of the criteria of the three kinds of organizations. So this actually sets in motion a application process for authorizers and continues all the way down on page 3 there. On 325, it sets up a review at least every 5 years of the authorizer's performance by the commissioner. So we'll be evaluating whether or not authorizers are doing their oversight. And if they're not, the commissioner would have authority to sanction or discipline that authorizer, including taking the right to authorize away from that particular authorizer. 334, 335, the department currently authorizes 10 schools, and this would just sunset them at a particular date. Page 4, as I said, 4.1, it gives the commissioner authority to establish guidelines and policies with regard to the approval of authorizers, their review and discipline. Subdivision 4 clarifies that the group of people who create a charter school must include a teacher, a licensed Minnesota teacher. The way that it is currently written is confusing. 418 establishes a section there where the authorizer must submit a separate affidavit for each school it proposes to authorize to the commissioner, and that the school developers must also submit a statement of legal assurances along with that affidavit to the commissioner. Then it sets how many days people have to respond if their concerns with the if the commissioner has concerns with the affidavit. And basically the affidavit is a documentation of the due diligence the authorizer has done for the approval of the school. On page 5, it goes into governance, and on page 5, line 10, if the first board is not named in the Articles of Corporation, the corporators must, within a reasonable time, hold the organization to elect the first board, and that the board has to be of non-related individuals. That is something that we put into all of the provisions on governance. If you go down to 525 or 523, we make it clear that elections must be posted in terms of 30 days before the election, that eligible voters, which are parents and staff members, must be notified of the election period. And then 525 deals with the issue of the governance structure itself. Currently, all charter schools must have a teacher majority board by the end of third year of operation, or they must get a waiver from the commissioner. This would establish, in this bill, three options for governance. One would be the teacher majority, and we have a number of schools that will die on the sword to keep the teacher majority because they are well run and teachers are very engaged in that school. The second option would be to create a board composed of one-third parents, one-third community people, and one-third teachers. And the third option in here is at least a board of 20% teachers on the board. Those are licensed teachers in the school. One of the reasons we are proposing that all options maintain some teachers on it is because one of the six purposes of charter schools is to provide professional development opportunities for teachers, including the right to be involved in the governance of the school, if you go back to the six purposes of charter schools. We also put a process in for changing the governance structure of the school that is not really done willy-nilly.
Yes. So just a second. Senator Bonoff has a question.
Madam Chair and Senator Scheid, Mr. Piccolo, I do not agree with the teacher majority board in general. I look to this bill to be able to make some changes given what we learned from the auditor, and I think that that while I appreciate the professional development opportunity for teachers to be on a board, and so I can respect the board with at least 20% of its members licensed teachers, I think that we're not dealing with the problem if we have a teacher majority board. That, you know, the idea of governance is you have to have checks and balances, that, you know, that the people who are within aren't best suited to be managing themselves, that you want to have outside people looking in. We want to make sure to have a professional caliber. If too many teachers are on the board, we're missing, you know, if you look at developing any board, you want to have a, you know, the outside experts in finance, outside experts in other kinds of policy, and that we are limiting, especially if you're only having five, we're just limiting the opportunity to have a professional management structure.
So, Mr. Piccolo?
Senator Saltzman and Senator Bonoff, what we are proposing here is that schools have the options if they wish to have a teacher majority, if they wish to have a teacher 20% board or one-third model, that they have the option to do whatever they believe is the best model for them. I mean, that's one of the pieces about charter schools is that they can create different models of doing things. And so we're trying to move away from the mandate from the teacher majority is the only way of doing it, to give schools options, but to provide some parameters around those options.
And Madam Chair and Mr. Piccolo, I would be interested, if Ms. Randall's still in the room, to hear her comments. But I understand what you're trying to accomplish, but I don't agree with it.
And Ms. Randall is here. She's coming to the table. And just to point out, Sarah Nabonoff, on line 1.13, when it has purposes of this section, you'll notice that there is the word or. So I think that we all tend to think that charter schools do all these things, but technically they only have to do one of these things at this point. So I think that we assume that it's about teaching, because like when you raised that, I saw that. So we need to keep that in mind. Ms. Randall?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Judy Randall. I'm with the Legislative Auditor's Office. Senator Bonoff, yeah, I think you recall our recommendation correctly. I've got the report in front of me, and I'll just read it. Our recommendation is that the legislature should amend the charter school law to remove the requirement that teachers comprise a majority of charter school board members. And I think you identified the reasons exactly as we talked about them and presented them, which is we spoke to charter schools that felt they did not get, they weren't able to get necessarily all the expertise they wanted for running a board, the legal, financial, and, you know, governance expertise necessarily from their teachers. You know, we did not propose specific language in our report, but we do recommend removing the teacher majority requirement.
So, Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, and that's what this does.
And so
it removes the requirement of a teacher majority board. It leaves the option, and if you're saying that you don't want the option, that's one thing. But to, you know, I think, I don't know if you're going to point to all situations where are necessarily being badly run because teachers have a majority on the board. I mean, I think because we require it now, and we're saying we want to leave it to the their discretion, and I'm guessing that you know they would make choices that were appropriate. But there are some schools that are very well run and managed.
Madam Chair and Senator Schein, I know I'm a co-author on this bill, but I've learned and, my thinking has evolved. And so I would prefer that it was not an option because, you know, yes, there are some that are run excellently with a teacher majority board, but I think we we cannot be there to make sure that exists in every situation. And so I think that just as a matter of practice, just like in any company, I wouldn't want the majority of the members being the employees of the company because I think we lose the proper checks and balances in the governance structure. So I'd rather that was no longer an option because I think there have been enough trouble in our management that we ought to just take that as an option off the table.
And Madam Chair, and that's fine. We can disagree on that. I think we have other measures of accountability in here that will deal with, you know, your concern there. So,
why don't we continue that and then maybe just see at the end because we could almost even take out option one and two and just leave three and you could accomplish almost the same thing. I mean, without specifically naming that, but that's another discussion.
Senator Saltzman, we're walking through the bill as it exists. We have made amendments in the House on some of these issues, but I do want to follow what's in the bill.
Thank you.
On page 6.8, we put in a provision that charter school board members must attend training on governance, their roles and responsibilities, and training in school finances and financial management and oversight. And if a board member does not complete that within 12 months of being seated on the board, they're off the board. We believe that very strongly that people do need to have training about what governance is and their roles and responsibilities. And this is a complex organization because you have a nonprofit organization who's operating a public institution. And there is no other organization on the face of the earth like the way the law currently sets up charter schools. And so people need to have training around this whole effort. In 6.16, we deal with conflict of interest with regard to authorizers and the schools they authorize, that the granting or renewal of a charter by an authorizer must not be contingent on the school being required to contract, lease, or purchase services from an authorizer. We have had problems in the past, and we've actually had schools closed because of that, because authorizers were overcharging schools for services and so forth. Any potential contract, lease, or purchase must be done through an open bidding process and must be a separate contract other than the charter contract itself. So we want to make it very clear there that there's a division in those services and that it's transparent in terms of how it's done. We also have in here that if it is about managing and doing financial for the schools, that it has to be documented and there must be two bids because you can hardly be doing oversight of the finances if you are doing the financial books. The next section basically deals with supplementary affidavits for when schools want to expand their grades or additional sites. Again, the basic change here is that instead of the commissioner doing the final approval of the actual expansion or the grades, it is the authorizer that is going to be required to do all the due diligence and then submit an affidavit to the commissioner stating out what they did as due diligence before they gave approval. But if the commissioner would review the affidavit and if the authorizer has not done due diligence, then the commissioner could say to the authorizer, go back and redo some things to make sure that the due diligence has been done. The next section on page 7 clarifies what kind of financial training they must provide the department. Under current law, they must provide. We have in the House language taken this out, so I won't go there for very long. Mr. Pickle,
a question, and I apologize. If we could go back to the section between 412 and 420,
sure,
where it is under formation of a school, and it notes that an individual licensed teacher or a group of individuals, which must include at least one licensed teacher, may establish a public charter school. And then it goes on that a school district on line 414, a school district may create a corporation for the purpose of creating a charter school. Is this the same, or how does this relate to a school district that then is the sponsor of a charter school?
This, Senator Saltzman, this language actually is just a repeat from the previous paragraph that was struck out, but re kind of put in some order to make sense logically. So school districts do have the right to create a corporation if they do a conversion school currently. So this is not new language. It's just taken from the previous paragraph that was all jumbled around and put in right order.
Thank you very much.
Let's see, where were we? Okay, conflict of interest and subdivision 4A at the bottom page 7 and the top of page 8. What we have done here in the legislative auditor report, it was pointed out that there are three sets of conflict of interest laws that charter schools must follow, and they often contradict each other or are in conflict, and that we should be following federal standard for conflict of interest. So this language is language from the federal statutes regarding conflict of interest for boards and employees of charter schools. To bring it to a higher standard, basically, and a common standard so that everybody knows what the rules are. Because that has been a problematic issue when you have three sets of conflict of interest laws, which one applies when. Going down to subdivision 6 on page 9, that's the next area where there's substantial changes. About the charter contract itself.
Question from Senator Bonoff, Mr. Sure. Bigelow.
Yes.
Madam Chair, Senator Scheid says a violation of this requirement renders the contract void. The charter school's aid may be reduced by the commissioner. Do you think that reduced is a strong enough word in this context?
Well, Madam Chair, Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff, I'd like Mr. Piccolo to respond to that. I think he knows more particularly what we're...
Senator Saltzman, Senator Bonoff, this would be for a particular violation of the law that the contract would be null and void, and then the commissioner could penalize the school for the amount of that violation. So it's specific to a particular incident rather than just general punishment that you can cut aid 10% or something.
Madam Chair, Mr. Piccolo, I guess I'm just asking the question with when we discover that there's financial misdealings, do we have enough teeth in our provision to really address it with the way this is drafted, do you think?
Senator Saltzman and Senator Bonoff, yes, I believe so, because currently there is very little teeth in the law, and this provides much stronger teeth, and it actually provides a penalty for the first time if there's a violation of conflict of interest.
Please continue, and thank you.
Let's see. Page 9 on the charter contract. Again, it clarifies the number of days. It also puts a requirement that it is up to the authorizer to submit the copy of the charter contract to the commissioner within 10 business days of its execution. It then says on 9/11, declaration of the purposes. We each are proposing changing the law that schools must meet more than one purpose of the law. One of the concerns that we've heard through the course of time is, where's the innovation? One of the concerns that we've had is that the department has defined that the one purpose you must meet under the charter school law is purpose one, which is about improving pupil learning. And since the law only requires one purpose, everybody has to follow that one. And so we're saying that schools must also address one of the other purposes of the law, which are about innovation. And you will see later on in the bill, we put it in the annual report that they must report annually on what is the innovation they are doing and how are they implementing it. So we are making this tougher on people who want to create schools and for our schools, that there is dual purpose, both academic achievement and innovation. The rest of it is just describing, clarifying description of what needs to be in the contract. We propose on line 927 that the contract be up to 5 years initially and also for renewals. One of the things we've heard from sponsors or authorizers is that when it is on a three-year cycle, that they only really have 2 years of data to make a decision on renewal because they have to make decisions for renewal about 6 months in advance, and the data for the third year is not there. This would just give the option for a longer period. They can still put a school on a one-year contract, a two-year contract, a three- or four-year, and that's a way of authorizers have of leveraging to the schools to address certain issues. 9.30 changes one little word, but is an important word. It changed the word if to how. One of the concerns that people have is that charter schools are not addressing special ed, which they are required to do. But this makes it very clear from day one, you must be focused on how you are going to serve kids who are special ed and not give the impression to anybody that you may not have special ed kids. Page 10, subdivision 6A, we put a requirement, we put the authority for the commissioner to withhold aid if the school has not submitted their audit by January 31st to the commissioner. There is absolutely no reason why audits are not submitted to the commissioner on time, and schools, we believe, should foresee a penalty if they don't get it done. T- 10.2 just clarifies language about which requirements of other laws charter schools are required to follow. And this is an example. Here's an example of a law. Charter schools, because they are at-will employers or under general employment law, they are required to follow 181, Minnesota Statute 181, which deals with the one of the issues earlier about whistleblower. They're already required to follow whistleblower laws under 181. But because the way this paragraph is currently written, it's unclear whether other laws, unless they specifically say charter schools in them, apply. And this is trying to say any law that applies to charter schools directly or in general, like employment laws, would apply to charter schools because of the status of their employer relationship. Subdivision 8 adds federal that schools need to meet federal safety and health requirements. And takes out a word that says a sponsor may authorize a charter program. A charter is not a program, it is a school. Line 11.3 says, clarifies that charter schools may not charge tuition to students who reside in Minnesota. 11, 13, 14, and 15 take out those conflict of interest provisions that conflict with each other at the recommendation of the legislative auditor.
Question, Mr. Piccolo,
yes.
Is that on 11.13, number F, a charter school may not charge tuition to students who reside in Minnesota.
Yes.
If there is tuition received, is their general education aid going to be reduced accordingly?
We're just trying to clarify, Senator Saltman, we're just trying to clarify that they cannot charge students in Minnesota because they get aid. But we do have, along the borders, requests from students from other bordering states sometimes, whether they can come to a charter school in Minnesota, and they do not qualify for tuition aid, but they could charge if they wanted to come across the border.
Madam Chair, I think the policy question, with your permission, is that there's still dollars coming with those students. The student a kid that comes over from Minnesota, I believe, is still generating general education aid.
If they're from Wisconsin, or?
Yes. Is that not accurate? Is that not your understanding?
Madam Chair, okay. Our understanding is if a kid comes from Wisconsin, they don't bring anything with them.
We'll
there's
check
not
on
reciprocity
we'll
for
like
K-12.
Right. What we did do in, I think this might be a unique circumstance, Madam Chair. Last year in the K-12 bill, we had a reciprocity agreement with, and the department is, I believe, in its final stages, if not completed, the negotiation process with South Dakota. So the question then does become, if perchance the department extends that reciprocity to other states, North Dakota, Wisconsin, we're establishing permanent law here that may be a further reach than was originally intended.
Okay, so we'll check on that, and that's a good point. Thank you, Mr. Nauman.
Page 12, at the top of page 12, we take out language that was put in the law for a particular charter school many years ago and is now a contention. There's been a lawsuit that is now at the state Supreme Court about whether a town or is the same as a city. And we believe that this shouldn't even be an issue about enrollment. So to take it out. And then to add that charter schools must develop and publish their lottery policy and process so that it's very transparent to all parents. 12.9 would allow children of school employees to be given preference before the lottery. And then on 12 and 13, to make clear that charters, to clarify further that schools may not establish any criteria requirements for admission. It's there, but to make it even stronger and clearer to everybody. Because we have run into some situations where things are kind of vague. Subdivision 14 on page 13 defines that the says the school must publish an annual report and it must be approved by the board of directors. That's a measure of accountability. It defines what at least has to be in the annual report and that it must be distributed to commissioner, authorizer, school employees, parents, and legal guardians so that there is some accountability and transparency in terms of this. In the House, we have agreed to language to also require that it be put on websites and so forth. Subdivision 15 basically just changes to reflect the new process that the evaluation process of the authorizer has to be reviewed by the commissioner and not the individual reviews. 1320 is about the fee that authorizers receive. This language in here reflected where we were at in the discussion between authorizers and schools back in January when the bill was introduced, and we have subsequently come to some agreement on that in the House legislation, so we do have an actual compromise on that. But what this basically does is two things. One, it takes out a dollar amount in the law and ties it to the formula, the ADM formula, and also sets a higher rate for authorizers' fees because we are asking authorizers to do much more than they have done in the past. And so there's a significant increase in fee for next year. If the compromise would be put in the bill and be enacted, authorizers would see a threefold increase in potential revenue for next year, and it would go up to and be implemented over a four-year period of time to the maximums. Also on page 1330.
Excuse me. Yes. Madam Chair, I just want to make sure that you know that we have already agreed to change there, so don't focus, I think, on that particular, those numbers.
Point, right. On 13 point. And just, you know, we have been watching the House very, well, I guess kind of carefully, and have noted some of their changes and have looked at them and perhaps checked to make sure that maybe we could say them better, but keep with the intent.
Sure.
So some of those things are being discussed. So
undoubtedly.
So I very much appreciate that. Very much.
1330 requires allows the sponsor or authorizer to charge a fee during the pre-operational year. That has always been a questionable issue whether it can, and that's a year when they need to be doing a significant oversight while the school is in its planning year, and there's not been resources there. And then 1332 and on basically says authorizers must submit an annual report of what they have been expending for authorization, both for the individual school and overall. 1431, lease space. Basically, it says that authorizers can lease from any property owner, and that it removes the requirement that those leases be reviewed by the department administration and leaves it up to the Department of Education, because they review leases and for lease aid every year anyway.
So question, Mr. Yes. Piccolo, on line 14.34, and I know that this has been in statute before, right, that if the space is leased from a sectarian organization and is constructed as a school facility, I think that probably the intent is that there could be a Catholic church or a Lutheran church or whatever that has closed and there is space there. And that may be one issue, that you have an empty school. But what if there is an empty church that is bought by another sectarian organization for a charter school? I think there's a little difference between you are leasing space from a sectarian organization that school, it was their building, it was closed, versus another sectarian organization coming in that would buy a different group buying it. Because I think the intent here is that we only allow that because that's where the space is. Does that make sense?
Senator Saltzman, if the building, the law requires that if the building it was built as a school building, that even if it's sold to another sectarian organization, the building was still built as a school building. So that would not change whoever the owner is, because it still has to be built as a school facility. So, for example, if St. Ambrose School in Woodbury, if St. Ambrose sold their building to Peace Lutheran Church, the building itself that was is the school building in Woodbury, St. Ambrose building in Woodbury, was still built as a school building. So it wouldn't make any difference who the sectarian owner is, because it's about the building itself was built as a school facility.
I understand that, but I'm missing something here. But on line 14.33 is that a school district may lease space from a nonprofit, non-sectarian organization.
Right.
A sectarian organization could not build a building, a school building, and lease it to a charter school, correct?
Senator Saltzman, if they built it, they could not be building it just for the charter school, because the charter school cannot enter into a prospective lease agreement without approval of the department.
Okay, I guess I need to work on this a little bit more.
I think it might be a little vague, Madam Chair. I see what you're saying.
Is that, I understand the original intent is that if there was a building that was empty, but the question is that if a different sectarian organization comes in, we are then leasing from a sectarian organization that has bought the school, perhaps particularly to lease back to a charter school, and this would allow that, I believe. Okay with that, or Mr. Cordy, do you?
Senator Saltzman, I think if that is unclear, we can work.
Yeah. Okay, to I'll get that. I'll see if I can tighten this up a little bit with my intent. Thank you.
And then on page 15.78 and 8, basically what we propose is language to allow charter schools who have been in existence 5 years or more to form a separate non-building company upon approval of the authorizer. As we talked earlier, we have proposed other more detailed language than what's in this bill in the House version. Subdivision 18 is archaic language. This language was in place in the original law that the sponsor has to give approval for a charter school to raise any kind of funding. And that made sense when the school district, when only school districts could be sponsors. But now that colleges, universities, and nonprofits can, this language is not ever used. Subdivision 19 clarifies what information must be disseminated by whom. Subdivision 20, line 1525, provides a date of February 1st if a teacher is on leave from a traditional district to a charter school, by which they must notify their district if they're coming back or staying on leave. 1513 takes out archaic language that says that if a teacher is on leave from a district, they are responsible for paying TRA for both the employer and the employee, but charter schools under subdivisions 22 are required to pay the employee part of TRA, so it's confusing who needs to pay it. So we're just clarifying that it's the school that pays TRA. Section 23 clarifies the number of days that people have to give notice for non-renewal. Page 17.3 through 5 basically says when a contract is terminated or not renewal for cause, there is no appeal and there can be no transfer of the authorization, which is currently allowed. If you are closing a school down because they haven't performed, they should not be able to get a new authorizer. Under current law, they could appeal to the commissioner to get a new authorizer, and we don't believe if a school is not performing that they should be able to continue in existence. 17.6, basically this is about mutual transfer. If the authorizer and the school just are not the right fit, this provides a way for them to find a new sponsor and to do it in an amicable way without that there's no cause here. And that has occurred on several occasions. 17.8, that section there, subdivision D there, basically clarifies language that the commissioner has authority to terminate a contract between an authorizer and a school if the school has failure to meet generally accepted standards of fiscal management or fiscal mismanagement, also repeated or major violations of law, or the authorizer has not done their job. And you can see the reasons why they could void the contract if the authorizer has not done their job. On page 18, there's revisions of definitions. And then on page 19, there are two new definitions, what an application is and what an affidavit is. Both of those terms have appeared in the law since 1991, but never were defined, and so we give definition. In the House version, we actually have two definitions for application, one for the application for the authorizer and one for the school.
And thank you very much, Mr. Piccolo. That was very good. I wonder if Mr. Brown could come up on page 17, between lines 1718 and 1730, regarding the commissioner on the non-renewal or termination of a charter school contract. If you could respond, Mr. Brown, to the language that has been proposed in subsection D. 18 through 1731.
Madam Chair, Morgan Brown with the Department of Education. Obviously, this language has been refined on the House side, as you referenced. The department really doesn't have any concerns with this language per se. I mean, we've kind of worked out, Madam Chair, we've essentially worked out language that we agree on in the House bill. So I don't want to bicker over specific language here, but we're in the same agreement essentially about the commissioner's authority to terminate charter school contracts.
So we should look at the House language, is what you're saying, Mr. Brown?
Yep. Yes, in the bill that was reported out of the House Education Policy Committee.
All right. So, Mr. Brown, while you're here, we'll be hearing the agency clone bill, because the agency bill is in the omnibus policy bill, but we've also pulled that out as a separate bill. Does the department generally support this bill? Is this pretty much in line with what the department bill is doing as well?
Yeah. Madam Chair, what you will find when I go very quickly through the department bill is that there's a lot of overlap, particularly with regard to the OLA recommendations. And again, as this bill has gone through the House Policy Committee, we've worked very closely with the Charter School Association and the House author over there. So wherever there is commonality, that we had agreed language so that we were on the same page. And in addition, we've had situations where, as part of putting that bill forward, the Charter School Association has agreed to take language that was originally in our department bill and vice versa. So
do you support this bill then, is what I'm asking?
Well, the department supports our bill as it's going through the House right now. There are probably a couple of provisions where we have some concerns. The one that we already talked about relates to the new language in Subdivision 17 on lease aid with regards to recognizing nonprofit building corporations. And that, again, that's something we'd be happy to talk to you about, but that was not in the department's original bill.
Okay. Thank you very much. What I'd like to ask is if we could get through the other two bills and then take some general testimony from people that may be here with other groups, and I promised we'll move through those rather quickly, unless there's someone who wanted, there was something very specific in this bill that you would like to testify to. Mr. Mangini, did you have anything you wanted to add?
Madam Chair, members, Yusuf Mangini, Office of the Superintendent, Director, Office of Educational Equity, and Charter School Liaison for St. Paul Public Schools. A couple of questions or rhetorical questions or issues that I'd like to share with you. Line 230 on page 2, I was one of the founders of the Minnesota Council on Nonprofits and served for a number of years on committees and part of the governance of the Minnesota Council on Foundations. Neither of these institutions has anything to do with instructional education. And if John Pratt or Marcia Abner need some money, I'd be happy to make a contribution. But I'm not sure how requiring membership in them would advance the educational mission of charter schools. Similarly, line 3.7, to suggest that a nonprofit has existed for 25 years may also not be a pure measure of quality. In terms of section 3.25, I'd like to speak to that in particular, because in the back of the proposed bill, there is a requirement that authorizers submit annual reports outlining the expenditures appropriated as part of the monitoring. And section 3.25, I think, identifies an excellent service that the Minnesota Department of Education already provides. They review any school quality review process, which we're required to do as part of the renewal of a contract. Section 4.35 establishes a similar process for MDE for the submission of an affidavit for a new school. And I would suggest that if MDE, and we have an excellent relationship with Morgan Brown, David Hartman, and the charter school specialists at MDE, if they believe that a sponsor slash authorizer is not performing their responsibilities diligently, we would be very happy with MDE being given the option to require that a sponsor provide an auditing of what responsibilities and expenditures they are allocating. I mention this because I think it could be counterproductive. Most sponsor authorizers do not oversee charter schools as their sole responsibility. It is among a number of responsibilities, and I would hate to have a bookkeeping responsibility divert sponsors and authorizers from the real focus of our role, which is ensuring that charter schools meet the minimum standards and that the needs of the students and the family and the staff are being met. So I don't have any problem with accountability, but I think that MDE is in an ideal role to provide that oversight of whether a sponsor or authorizer is doing an adequate job in terms of ensuring that the school is fulfilling its mission and addressing the needs of students and of the legislature. So 4.25 and 3.25 both speak adequately to that, and we'd be very happy to have MDE be given that option of expecting additional information because, simply put, let the authorizers focus on what their role is. And for us, St. Paul Public Schools, 5,000 hours a year, in-kind contributions, donations, allowing staff members from charter schools to attend professional development workshops, phone calls, emails, printing, charter directors meeting, it would be onerous and bureaucratic to have to track every single aspect of that, and I would not want it to divert from ensuring that we as an authorizer and the charter are fulfilling their role and obligation.
Mr. Mangini, that on one hand, there's been some concerns that there's this the competition or there aren't always the best relationships between charter schools and district schools. And so I think some of this is that when a district school does authorize a charter school that that fees are appropriate. But then what you're explaining here is that exactly what we would like to see happen, I think, is that there's a sharing between our district and our charter schools. And sometimes it's, again, mandates that we require restrict schools from doing the good work we like them to focus on and that they're doing paperwork. So maybe perhaps we can continue this conversation outside of this meeting today and see if there's some common ground here so that we're able to accomplish both. Protect charter schools from, you know, being required to use specific services, that there's a bidding process, and yet some of those things that happen. And, you know, perhaps Mr. Piccolo, if you could respond to his comments, that might be helpful.
Senator Saltzman, I think the distinction that we would see is that the accountability that's asked for is about the fee part of it. All the things that St. Paul does that is are a wonderful relationship that they do have with the schools they sponsor about providing in-service and so forth, that would be outside of that oversight provision. It is about the oversight. What are they spending in terms of oversight? Because that's the part that schools are actually going to be paying for, and there's going to be the proposal is a substantial increase in fees for the sponsors. In fact, it is a six-fold increase over the next, when it's all phased in, from what sponsors currently get.
So let me ask if when a charter school board, there's got to be some sort of coming together between, you know, an authorizer and a charter school, that if a charter school board meets its sponsor, can that be part of a contract? Because if a charter school board feels that its authorizer isn't serving them well, can they potentially go and find a different authorizer? I hope that there's a good relationship between them. So when I hear that we're making it much more difficult, so Mr. Piccolo?
Senator Saltzman, I think part of the revision of this whole process of authorization does provide through that performance review mm-hmm. by the Department of Sponsors an opportunity for schools to say, hey, our sponsor's not doing anything. I mean, we do have sponsors who have never stepped foot in a charter school. and I could name, but I'm not going to name those. And they come in all different categories of potential sponsors. But on the other hand, we have sponsors like St. Paul who are there on a regular basis and doing their job. And so what we are saying is that there needs to be accountability on both sides in terms of the process. And so that's why the review of sponsor authorization would be done on an ongoing basis, so there is an opportunity. There's also the opportunity if a sponsor and the charter school in particular, you know, our different philosophies and so forth, that's a voluntary termination. They can both say, you know, we're not the right fit for each other, and why don't we both move on, and gives a process for doing that.
Very good. Perhaps we need a QComp program for charter school sponsors, is what I'm hearing. All right. Is there anyone else who would like in?
I did have a few more comments,
perhaps,
Madam Chair, members.
Yes.
Although we're not totally in agreement, I don't have a problem with a charter requesting that MDE exercise that oversight should the legislature give them the responsibility to require it on our part. And I don't think it needs to be every 5 years. Again, it occurs every time there's an affidavit for a new school or every time we submit the review of the renewal of a contract for an existing charter school. MDE does have a quite thorough review process of the review that we do as part of that renewal process. I don't believe that a board should exist for 3 years without holding elections. I also don't believe that new board members on a charter school should be in the dark for an entire year before they're required to get training in terms of governance, in terms of contract negotiations, in terms of purchasing, in terms of all of the business that comes before the independent board of education for a charter school. And MDE offers excellent training for sponsors and for new charters. And I would encourage you to consider that new board members of charter schools undergo the necessary training within a 3 to 6 month period. I think a year is a long time to be in the dark and not be able to read financials or understand what's going on, particularly if you've had limited governing experience in the past. And I've served on at least 100 boards in my life. I'm 60 years old, and I know how important it is that people be up to speed and able to participate in the governance dialogue concerning the policies of a specific organization. Just a couple more.
And if you might tell us them very quickly, that would be helpful.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, but I appreciate your testimony.
On page, I don't have my glasses on, page 10 at the top of the page, page 10-1, I think needs to be consistent with subdivision 14. When a charter school submits an annual report, a copy of that annual report should also be submitted to the authorizer. We should not have to wait until 10 days after the deadline to have MDE contact us to tell us that the report has not been submitted. If the requirement is that it be submitted to the authorizer and to MDE, we would know that and raise the question ourselves. In subdivision 14, it says that the charter school also has to submit a copy to parents and to the authorizer, but there's no time limit on that. So again, we're left with having to either write or call or email and request information that is public that we ought to have, so that if there are audit or management or financial issues that an independent auditor has concerns over, that we can request an opportunity to work with them to try and resolve them while they're still manageable and not find out about it after it becomes a headline in the Pioneer Press. So just give us the information so that we can fulfill our role in a timely fashion. And I think I've the last comment that I want to make is related to page 15, line 15.14. I'm not sure that charter schools want authorizers disseminating information about them. It says it must, but that's pretty ambiguity. You know, do we give them their phone number, give them their web page? MDE does a very good job of providing information. We hold a parent information fair each year, and we invite every charter, religious, public, or private school in the city of St. Paul to participate in that. And we have absolutely no problems with choice, to the extent that we respect whatever choice parents make, whether it's homeschool, public, public charter, or religious, whatever that happens to be. I'm not certain what that means, that an authorizer has to take time away from its responsibilities to be promoting someone else. We certainly wouldn't expect charter schools to be required to promote the public schools in the city of St. Paul. And so,
Chair, if I just might, I think it's
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, we're striking sponsor. You know, we've redefined authorizer, but I think current law requires it. So,
So it's just be changed. But it's but I appreciate the perspective.
I understand
that. Right.
It's very ambiguous, Madam Chair.
Senator.
In subdivision 19, what we actually have done is separate the two pieces. All authorizers in the department would be required to disseminate to the public on how to form and operate a charter school, which is basically their process for if they sponsor charter schools or open to sponsoring new charter schools, that they publish that information to people about how they do that. And we separated the dissemination about how to utilize the offerings of a school and put that responsibility on the school. So the about what schools there are and what their programs are, we take away from the authorizer, which it currently has, and put it on the responsibility of the school.
So on line 15-16, charter schools must demonstrate information about how to utilize the offerings of a charter school. Is that basically marketing?
It's about information about their school and what their program is.
Right. And in doing that, some of the issues that have come up, and this is another issue, I don't want to spend too much time on it, but I just, like, in seeing this, what if they disseminate to a specific population? Should we, when they disseminate information, is it to the entire community? What if information is only disseminated to a specific population, if it's a school that is for Latino children? When we require them to disseminate information, should we be clear who they are targeting? I know it says here it should be to students of color, at risk, low-income families, communities.
And that's already what's in law.
Mm-hmm.
Low-income families, communities, and students of color.
Right.
And we are proposing and at-risk kids.
Right, families. But we're changing of who, what information is disseminated. So I just wanted to – that's been a question that some has been brought up in some of our other meetings.
Madam Chair, I think it really is current law. I mean,
it
we've stricken the and, but current law says that sponsor and operators must disseminate the information to the public on how to form and operate a charter school and how to utilize the offerings. That's –
Madam Chair, and then we're just splitting between what authorizers have to do and what schools have to do to clarify that the sponsor is not responsible for disseminating information about every school that exists, charter schools. That's the charter school's responsibility, not the authorizer. So we're just delineating who has what role in
disseminating. And I do appreciate that, but we've also added something for charter schools to do in this paragraph as well, I think a little bit.
Madam Chair, operators, under current law, it says...
Are the charter schools, okay.
Are the charter schools themselves.
Okay, good. All right, are there any other questions? All right, what I'd like to do is move your bill, Senator Scheid, to be laid on the table.
And Madam Chair, and I understand that and I appreciate that. I do have to go to another meeting. I had things set up, and it's just a tough few weeks here for all of us.
So I really
am interested in the conversation. I know Mr. Piccolo is probably staying for that, and I'll be updated. But I apologize to you that I'm not going to be here to listen to all of it. But I will be.
Right.
I think you're meeting next Wednesday, I understand.
We're meeting next Wednesday, and we will have another probably a delete all amendment that will include many of these things that you've been hearing about today, discussions, and that will go through this committee and then we'll also go to E12. So there's going to be plenty of opportunity for people to talk about the bill.
Madam Chair, will people see that before it's offered at the meeting, or is it just...
We're going to try, but I'm not going to promise based on the fact that we're trying. I think some things came up today we'd like to work on, and however we can get that prepared in advance, we will work on that. And I will certainly talk with you outside of this meeting.
Okay, Madam Chair, thank you.
Thank you. So at this time, I would like to move Senator... Senator Wieger would like to move Senator Scheid's bill... 478 to be laid on the table.
Exactly.
Thank you. And all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Same sign, and the motion prevails. All right. Senator Bonoff, would you like to take the gavel? I'm going to Senator Bonoff.
Sure. 854 or 852? What's our pleasure? That's all easy.
Okay. Members, you have before you Senate File 852. Senator Saltzman.
Thank you very much. Today we have Senate File 852, which is a bill that came forward from Education Evolving. And there were a series of bills that were brought forward, and this is the charter school bill. But one of the things that also came forward from this group is the idea of how do we promote innovation in all of our schools, that charter schools should not have the monopoly on innovation, but we really need to be looking at how we encourage innovation and change and teacher participation and doing things differently in our schools to really promote student achievement. And so I do want to note, too, that many of the people who have worked on this bill were the founding, the godfathers of the charter school movement, and really did it because they believe that student achievement has to be our number one goal. But how do we, again, reflect on what has happened over the past 15 years, really to build on what we've learned, and also to encourage good things happening. So Kurt Johnson is with me, who is with Education Evolving, and I'm going to ask him to talk about the bill and the perhaps in the broader umbrella sense of what is being proposed this year.
Thank you, Senator, Madam Chair, and members. First, we would have the intention here of contributing to...
Could you please say your name for the record?
I'm sorry, Curtis Johnson with Education Evolving.
Thank you.
We'll try to help you with your schedule by being pointedly brief with this, not going through the bill, but pointing to the essential features. I would like to point out that, for the record, Senator Scheid did vote for the 1991 bill. Maybe somebody will remind her of that. I appreciate the kind comments she made about former Governor Carlson, in whose administration I had the honor to serve. We do, as Senator Saltzman said, offer through this bill a kind of variation on the approach that you've already been talking about. We do take note of Mr. Piccolo's preference for the word authorizer versus sponsor. On the other hand, we think that the trick here is to redefine what sponsorship means with sufficient breadth and specificity that no matter what term you're using, we're going to get a different kind of result. What we tried to do in contributing to the content of this bill was to be directly responsive to the criticisms and the concerns of the Office of the Legislative Auditor. So we've tailored what we think the essential elements are to that, and they are three in number. First of all, to sort out the roles and responsibilities. And briefly put, it's that the MDE should be responsible and accountable for approving and overseeing sponsors, and then in turn, sponsors would be responsible and accountable for approving and overseeing schools. It means, of course, that the MDE would get out of the business of approving schools and overseeing schools directly. We would emphasize that what is contemplated in approving sponsors is a very rigorous process based on standards that are now pretty well developed. It would have the effect of raising the performance of sponsorship in the state. Number two, the bill would amend the current law to permit a new kind of sponsor, something we're calling a single-purpose sponsor. The rationale is pretty simple. Under current law, the sponsors we have for current chartered schools, this may be the third, fourth, fifth, or sixth priority for those organizations. They have a mission that's directed at something else as a priority. Under this amendment, all sponsors would be are required to be approved. It's likely that a number of these will not decide to apply for approval. Some sponsors would not be able to meet the new sponsoring standard, so even if they did apply, they might not be approved. And third, as MDE assumes new responsibilities of approving and overseeing sponsors, We would contemplate getting rid of the inherent conflict of interest of having them also overseeing schools. So for those reasons, it seems to make sense to have some sponsors in the field here whose sole business is to authorize and oversee new schools. The third element of this has been testimony already about that there appears to be agreement about the changing fees for sponsors from chartered schools. We wouldn't want to interfere with that at all. And the fourth and last item, just to make a quick reference to it, that to assist the department in reviewing and approving and renewing authorizers, this bill would suggest that the state create a new state-level agency that is a public-private partnership. We're calling, for purposes here, New Schools Minnesota. And it is roughly modeled after the successful experience that you would recognize with the structure of Serve Minnesota. You'll hear more about that in the next couple of weeks because that is a separate bill.
So this, to add, Madam Chair, that with this bill, I think that we have also heard a number of cases where schools, a sponsor is not working, that currently the department sponsors a number of charter schools, and the department has suggested that they no longer want to sponsor charter schools, to be the direct sponsor. So for some of these schools that are going to be sponsor, that this would be an opportunity to look at creating, like we said, a single purpose sponsor that perhaps would be really, really focused on sponsorship of charter schools, and that there would not be numerous but three specific that would be selected, and again under the umbrella of New Schools Minnesota, which also will be working on how do we create innovation within our public district schools by allowing a different form of governance, allow them to have some of the flexibility that charter schools now have. That's a separate bill, but truly look at this as really going back to what were the purposes of charter schools originally, and ensuring that we focus on those. I think that right now there we just talked about the fact that of the six purposes, a charter school only has to really focus on one of them, and yet when we look at that list, I would perhaps suggest that we should be really encouraging charter schools to look at four, five, or six of them, because that is where we've really encouraged this this whole experience to go, that we've really allowed the flexibility so that there can be more change, innovation, and greater student achievement.
Senator Saltzman, I'm a little bit uncertain as to what the purpose of this bill is, and it sounds like you've referred to another bill, or Mr. Johnson did, with regard to Serve Minnesota. Are these two bills linked, and is it possible for one to go without the other? And are you really, in introducing this bill, suggesting that this would be a pilot for a new way to approach the management of charter schools, and how does that correlate to our existing charter school structure?
And an excellent question, Madam Chair. If you saw in Senator Scheid's bill, you'll see in the agency bill that there is the Charter School Advisory Board has been reinstated. And so the New Schools Minnesota Board that is referenced here would actually replace that, but would be a board that would oversee not only charter school, advise charter schools, but also encourage innovation within our district schools. And that board would then, and again, you would have to do both, but I think what is particularly interesting here is a single purpose sponsor, that we would be requiring that to happen instead of suggesting is that the commissioner, you know, may approve these single purpose sponsors that would perhaps be a place for charter schools that do not want to work with a existing existing sponsor, and also for those schools that right now that MD has now notified that as of I think 2011 they need to find a different sponsor. So
Senator Saltzman, so this New Schools Minnesota, you're suggesting that they would become an advisory council for all charter schools?
Yes, Madam Chair. They would replace or be in place of the Charter School Advisory Board that is in Senator Scheid's bill, which we just heard. It would be a different kind of advisory board. And maybe Mr. Johnson would like to reflect on that a little bit more on the purpose of that organization.
No, I think, Madam Chair and members, the philosophy around it is just as Senator Saltzman suggests. It's to put something in place that will be a place to go to for assistance in trying to create more innovative schools. It would be a place that could collect private donations from foundations, from corporations. It'd be a place that could provide some technical assistance, and in the roles that Senator Saltzman was referring to, could advise the commissioner and the department in the process of reviewing and approving the sponsors. I think, Madam Chair, as Senator Saltzman said, the two biggest things in this bill that give it its value added to your process here, one is the idea of a single-purpose sponsor, and we would suggest here that you approve up to three for the next biennium. But secondly, to be fully responsive to the concerns of the legislative auditor, you absolutely have to sort out what the department does. And it's currently looks like it could get muddied between both overseeing schools, being responsible for schools, but also approving the sponsors. And we're suggesting make a clean separation. Department approves sponsors, and sponsors approve schools. That way you know where the chain of accountability is.
And Senator Saltzman, Mr. Johnson, so I understand the department approves sponsors and the sponsors approve schools. And so what kind of oversight would New Schools Minnesota be providing?
In that respect, Madam Chair, they would be an advisory council, that they would be involved, that they would be. And perhaps another way of looking at this is that we really want to support good schools in this state. Good schools are good schools, whether they're a district school or a charter school. And we sat at this table about a week ago with a group of superintendents to talk about how we can support our district schools in being of having some of the same opportunities as a charter school. And as we sat around the table and heard about things that are happening across the state, there's no clearinghouse. There is no way to share success stories. Right now, there are several charter schools. I believe we heard from on the New Country School earlier, and we hear repeatedly of school districts who go to visit them, charter schools that have tried to replicate them. We talk a lot about charter schools that are supposed to be sort of lab schools, and yet there's no process in place for taking the things that are working and sharing them with other schools or encouraging that. So we keep starting up new schools, but do we ever look at the schools that are most successful and try to replicate them? So the New Schools Minnesota would be potentially sort of a freestanding agency similar to Serve Minnesota, which broke off from being sort of an MDE program to being a self-funded group that would be able to support innovation in both our district schools and charter schools. But it's another piece to look at as we've looked at how we address the state, how we address sponsors and charter schools, is what are different models that like we might look at. And so I wanted to bring this bill here today to show another alternative of how we might be able to address the accountability issue, but also how do we support the innovation, the replication, and those kind of issues as well.
So Senator Saltzman, so the creation of New Schools Minnesota as its own entity, that's contained in the other bill?
Yes, it is.
So what's confusing is hearing a bill that refers to an entity that we haven't heard about.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So it might be useful to...
Well, And I appreciate that, but that is not exactly a charter school bill. So this was pulled up because it talked about charter school sponsors, and it was referred to this under this subcommittee. So
thank you, members. I don't know if you all shared my confusion, but that's why I was having some trouble understanding. Thank you.
So unless there's other people who'd like to testify, Madam Chair, if I could move this bill to have it laid on the table.
Senator Saltzman moves that Senate file number 852 be laid on the table for possible inclusion. Thank you. All in favor? Say aye. Opposed? Same sign. Motion carries. Senator Saltzman?
Yes, I now have Senate file 867, Madam Chair. And on the last bill, Madam Chair, we did have Education Evolving come in earlier and presented their sort of package and did talk a little bit about New Schools Minnesota. It wasn't in great detail, but they did present some of their proposals. But it probably, I should have had handouts for you to reflect on that. So I believe Mr. Brown's going to help me with this, with Senate File 867. And just to clarify, Madam Chair, that this is the agency bill on charter schools, but it is also included in on the bill that Senator Wieger is carrying, which is the department policy bill.
So, Mr. Brown. Senator Saltzman, given we went through that other bill, could you just go through the changes that are different from the bill we've heard previously today?
I think Mr. Brown will be doing that, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we do want to thank Senator Saltzman for authoring the agency bill on charter schools and also Senator Wieger for authoring the policy bill. I will just hit the points that are different. Perhaps from Senator Shy's bill is introduced, and as I referenced before, there has been a lot of modifications to this language and improvements to the language as it's gone through the House, and a lot of it overlaps with some of the other bills that you've heard. If you look at Subdivision 3, this is where we deal with the changes that the OLA recommended in terms of the department now approving authorizers. There really isn't very much in terms of different language there. On Subdivision 4, formation of a school, and 4.24, this is where we deal with the OLA's recommendations, some of them regarding conflict of interest, some in terms of this new process where we're making clear that authorizers approve school, that the department approves authorizers and authorizers approve schools, and also the required training for charter school board members as the OLA recommended. A couple provisions in Subdivision 4 that are only...
Mr. Brown?
Yeah.
I just want to note in Subdivision 3, when we talk about the excluding a house of worship, I think you do go a little farther in your definition of how to protect the separation of church and state. And so you want to just state how you've stated that?
Right. I mean, the intent is the same, is that there would not be... that churches, synagogues, mosques would not be eligible to authorize a school. We've worked on that language a little more and refined it. We also have language in there that you'll see on line 3.7 that says an authorizer must reside in the state of Minnesota. So that's another limitation. Subdivision 4, as I mentioned, there's a couple additional sentences that I'll reference. At the top of page 6, line 6.1, we prohibit charter schools from offering any services or goods of value to students as an inducement term or condition of enrolling in the charter school.
Mr. Brown, has that been a problem in the past?
There has been concerns, for instance, of at least one example of charter schools when the student turned in enrollment, they were also essentially turning in a raffle ticket for items. And it's not, the problem is not, we don't have an issue with charter schools just like districts do sometimes saying, come to this charter school fair, we'll provide you some back-to-school supplies just for coming. What we don't want to see happening is making it a requirement that you could, have a raffle ticket if you submit an enrollment form. That's what we want to avoid.
This is a free steak dinner, Mr. Brown.
Yeah. On line 6.4, again, this we think this is consistent with the OLA's recommendations, but specifically making clear and affirming that the authorizer can prevent an approved charter school from opening. Even after it's been approved, it can during that plan year, can prevent it from opening into operation, and we have some refined language on that as well. On line 6.14, this is the area where the authorizer could potentially approve the charter school to expand either sites or grades after the existing charter is approved. And we've added a specific requirement here on 6.14 that essentially the expansion has to be supported by the academic performance of the charter school. I think in subdivision 4A, the conflict of interest language is all same intent as Senator Scheid and consistent with the OLA's recommendation. Again, that language has been modified. Subdivision 6 on the charter contract, the one new provision here you'll find on line 8.14, paragraph 12, where we've had, required that part of the contract has to be the plan for an orderly closing of the charter school so that in case a closure unfortunately ever does have to happen, that is already included in the contract, and there's some specifications there about that. If you'll move on to subdivision 11, which has to do on line 11.14, this has to do with employment and other operating matters. I wanted to affirm that this the intent here is to have this overlap with the other bill that Senator Saltzman introduced by specifically stating that the charter school board must comply with section 181.932, which is the whistleblower section of the broader employment law. And actually in the bill that's going through the House, we made it clear that actually charter schools have to comply with all of section 181 regarding employment law, which has very similar language to what Senator Saltzman has proposed in that other bill. And we also specify here that the charter school board, the refined language is a little different than this, but it essentially says that a charter school must provide the written conditions of employment to a teacher that they're hiring, as well as a copy of their personnel policies. So having additional clarification there. Moving on to subdivision 23, which begins on line 14.26. This is this whole section on the potential non-renewal or termination of a charter school by an authorizer. Again, the intent here is very similar to what was in the Scheid bill and consistent with the OLA's recommendations. The one piece that we have added right at the top of page 16 on line 16.1 is that we've added that the commissioner may have authority if an authorizer fails, essentially, in the commissioner's view, fails to terminate a charter school that should be closed, that in addition to current law that says the commissioner can come in, step in, and terminate that contract if the authorizer fails to act. Current law says for financial mismanagement or violations of the law, we've also added for a history of failure to meet the pupil performance requirements contained in the contract. So for repeated failure on academic performance. On line 17.8, and again, there's somewhat similar language in the Scheid bill. This is clarifying the kind of liability insurance that charter school boards are required to carry and that they need to inform the authorizer and the commissioner about that. And then the one section that is only in the department bill begins on line 17.26. This deals with 124D.11, which is the separate statute provision that deals with aids to charter schools. There are three changes here. One is we change it currently under the law. A charter school in its first year gets an upfront 10% payment and then gets metered payments after that. We want to change it to just say there shouldn't be the upfront 10% payment. They should just get regular metered payments, starting with that first payment and continuing throughout the year. It begins on paragraph B, line 17, 34, but the new language really is on the next page again, line 18.2. This lays out the whole process where if there is a charter school closure, what are the responsibilities of the charter school board, of the authorizer, of the department. We've had some practice and guidance on that for charter schools, but we really felt it needed to be in the statute. And it also clarifies what kind of aid a charter school that's closing in terms of holdbacks could get, assuming they don't owe the department or other entities funding when they close.
Mr. Brown, I noticed that there's nothing in here with regard to governance.
Excuse me, Madam Chair, I'm sorry, in the bill there's nothing with regard to governance? Are you talking about particularly the OLA's recommendation for to remove the teacher majority requirement?
Yes.
The department's position on this, we've actually consistently supported that OLA recommendation that the requirement be removed, that teachers should, that a school should be allowed to have a majority of teachers if it's so chose, and there's particularly some schools that are managed and run by teacher cooperatives where that might make sense, but that it not be a requirement. I will state frankly that when we have proposed that in the past, and we've had some very powerful testifiers, including Senator Ember Reichstadt-Young come forward, who was a strong supporter of removing that requirement from the law, and of course she was the senator who introduced the law, there has been strong opposition in certain sectors, and we don't seem to get anywhere with it. And so this year we chose to defer to the proposal that Max has made in their bill to see if that might get some movement and discussion going about how we could change that requirement rather than just having the same old battle of some folks not wanting to see that requirement removed and the department wanting to see it removed.
Mr. Brown, and does the governor support all of the changes that you've put forward in this bill?
Yes, and the governor and the commissioner support all of the recommendations the legislative auditor made, including the one to reform the teacher majority requirement.
And Mr. Brown, would you say that you, as well as the commissioner, would support what I requested, which is that it not be allowed to have a majority?
Madam Chair, to be honest, we would have reservations about not allowing it as an option, period, because there are some charter schools out there that are particularly designed, especially those that are essentially run by teacher cooperatives, where they are the management. There is, it's kind of flipping the old model on its head. There's not an administrator that teachers report to. The teachers are the managers and essentially run the school essentially by consensus in terms of setting pay scales and curriculum and everything. In that case, it might make sense to have a teacher majority board because you're not going to have the governance problem that we've all been talking about. So we wouldn't want to prohibit it from ever happening, but we certainly don't want to mandate it for schools that don't think it's a good governance model for them.
And Mr. Brown, Senator Saltzman, I might suggest that there be a way to, and perhaps you could work with the legislative auditor on that, there could be a way to have that particular exception or a different model of running a school written into that as an exception rather than continue to leave it as open-ended. I would still suggest that. And then I know, Senator Saltzman, you have a comment. But also I was wondering, is there a fiscal impact to Section 2 on page 17?
On Section 2, this is the one that creates the – oh, I'm sorry, on page 17. No, there would not be an impact, a fiscal impact in terms – this is the one where we're revising the aid, how the aid payments are metered out to charter schools. There would not be any cost implication. It's just shifting the way that the payments are made because right now we have these first-year charter schools that get the 10% upfront payment and then get a fewer number of metered payments throughout the year or a reduced number of metered payments. We're saying they should just get the same metered payments beginning with the start of the school year in which they are first operating throughout the year. So it would not result in them getting any less funding or any more funding. It just has to do with how the money is metered out.
Mr. Brown, so what would the effect be on the charter school in terms of their cash flow?
The charter school in that summer, right before they're going to open and operate in the fall, rather than getting the 10% upfront payment, they get a first meter payment of about 4.5%. The concern here for the the reason why we're doing that is some concerns about having that 10% upfront payment before we've got hard enrollment figures for a charter school and that you end charter schools that if they have accelerated enrollment figures then they already end up in the hole to the department when they start the year because they've been overpaid based on those previous amounts. And also then in that planning year, they usually have the federal startup money that helps them cash flow anything until the state metered payments start to flow.
Senator Saltzman, did you have a response to my question on the governance structure?
Yes, I did, Madam Chair. And that, as I mentioned earlier, this is going to be the vehicle for a bill that will have many of the things we've heard about, including the governance. And I think that Mr. Brown raised an excellent point about the teacher majority, because we have heard from a number of schools, and they're probably some of our best charter schools that are out there. They're usually very small schools, They probably are a lot of what we think about as a charter school, that where the teachers have come together, share responsibilities, work with parents, and work with, you know, community members. And I would hesitate to regulate that too much, but I think some of the issue is also when you have the executive director or superintendent serving on a school board, that that's an issue that I believe we may want to address, as well as we've also heard some comments about licensure of quote-unquote administrators. You will see a lot of times on a charter school that someone is named as the principal or the school director and may not have any experience in education at all, and yet they're leading that school. Now, we'd like to tap into that other experience. So one of the things that, like, we may want to look at, is there an alternative licensure that really is for charter school directors? Because I think a lot of the issues we hear about when there is when there are the concerns about the management is understanding the educational system and supervisory experience and those kind of things. So we may look at that, which I think will also address some of the concerns we've heard about. But again, in terms of board makeup, should a school director or else finance director, who's not also a teacher, be able to serve on a school board? I don't think our superintendents serve on the school board. And so that's something that I think we may want to look at also when this other revision comes out.
Thank you. And also, Mr. Brown, on page 5, line 5.22 in section D, you're talking about the charter school board member attending the training. How long do you and the department think that it should take for this training? Could it be done in less than a year? Is that the right amount of time?
Madam Chair, I think initially we recommended that it be within a 12-month period. There will be a process, at least initially, by which the department decides which training that it's going to provide directly, as it does in some cases currently, and which training it's going to review that other organizations may put forward and may ask the commissioner to approve it and determine whether it is in compliance with the statute. And then we could approve that training as well, and that would potentially be an option for board members. I understand the point about trying to do it more quickly, but given the variety of areas, there's about three or four different areas here, it may not be a training program, especially if there's it's best to have different potential providers of training with different areas of expertise offer it that a board member could just come and do in 1 or 2 days. They may actually need to go to several different training sessions and may elect to go for one training session to the School Board Association if they're approved to offer it, or to the Charter School Association if they're approved to offer it, or to the department. So that's why we didn't want to constrain the timeline too much.
Thank you. Senator Saltzman?
So on that same point, Madam Chair, perhaps we could work on this so that a school board member must begin training within, say, 3 months to be completed within, and maybe it's longer than a year, but probably by a year, so that, again, it's not, because, again, if it's a year and then someone thinks I can start it day 364 and it's going to take several weeks to get through all the courses, that may be something we want to look at. So very good point. Thank you for bringing that up.
Senator Saltzman, that sounds like a good plan.
Finally, Madam Chair, the one last provision that is in the department bill, which is on line 1820, this is paragraph C, deals with two circumstances. One is where the commissioner has directed the charter school to return federal, this says federal grant funds. We've also added state funds in the language going through the House. And if the charter school has not returned that we have the ability essentially to go in and take that funding out of the aid or withhold it from the aid that the charter school be owed. The other one is where if a charter school, if there is a bill from a school district, intermediate school district cooperative that has not been paid for 90 days and it's an undisputed claim, that that entity could notify the department and the department could directly pay that entity for the services that were provided and the funds that are owed directly, again, by withholding aid from the charter school.
Has this been a problem?
Has this been a problem, Mr. Brown?
Madam Chair, I would be cautious to not say it's been a wide problem. The concern that we primarily have that we want to avoid, although I think there's only maybe been one instance of it, is since charter schools sometimes contract with school districts for special education services, but then bill back those costs to the districts of residence. We certainly wouldn't want a situation where a charter school is billing back costs for special education to the district of residence, so the costs aren't being disputed, but they haven't paid another school district for the services, perhaps creating cash flow issues for that school district or intermediate school district. So this is just to make absolutely clear, if there was a delinquent bill, the department could pay that directly.
Mr. Brown, are the intermediates comfortable with this provision?
I have not talked to them recently, but my sense is they would be strongly supportive given some past situations.
And perhaps either Ms. McQuay or Mr. Kirk can answer. In regular school district law, do we have provisions, or Mr. Nauman, for if a school district doesn't pay an invoice that the state steps in? Is there any precedent for that?
Well, Madam Chair, I think what we're dealing with in regular school districts now is the new statewide tuition billing system, which has largely dealt with that whole bill back issue. And I think that this might be a little bit more of a unique circumstance that Mr. Brown is recommending a change to.
Thank you.
Very good. I'm done, Madam Chair, unless there's anyone else who wanted to testify on the bill. I would move to have it laid on the table.
Is there anybody else who wishes to testify for or against the bill? All right. Senator Saltzman moves Senate File 867 be recommended to pass and laid on the table. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Bill is passed. Thank you, Senator Saltzman. And Senator Saltzman, thanks for your very hard work on charter schools.
Are we adjourned, or does she want us? Does she want us?
Senator Saltzman, are you going to adjourn?
So that I just want to remind everyone that we'll have another meeting on Wednesday, March 11th at 3 o'clock. I believe we're in room 15. And we will attempt to get a draft out with some of the changes being recommended for discussion. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.
Oh, that was a long lineup. Cut this.